You're watching Bedtime Stevie Book Burst.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Red X TV, I'm Henrik. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Hope you're all doing very, very well out there in internet land. It's the 20th of March, 2025, which means it's the first day of spring, actually. So hope you guys enjoyed. We just had a hailstorm out here. So, you know, I'm not sure how much spring we got. Anyway, we're joined by Sam Parker today. As you can see, right there in studio. How's it going, Sam? Good to see you.
Good. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Good to meet you, Henrik.
Thank you for dropping by. Good to meet you as well. Yeah, awesome. We're going to talk a bit about, well, obviously we got to talk about the JFK files,
absolutely,
all that stuff that's coming out. There's other news as well. We'll see how much we can get to today. But they're ramping up some of the war efforts as well. New bombs are being dropped on Yemen, obviously. What, Israel is doing a ground invasion again?
Anything for Israel. Anything for our greatest ally. You know that.
So that's how she. That's how the cookie crumbles. But so lots to talk about. How do you like it up in these parts, Sam?
You know, I like it. I feel right at home. You know, of course, as you know, I grew up in Washington State, which is literally right next door. So, and then I served part of my LDS mission in Western Montana, the other next door. So right at home up here in Idaho and in the Pacific Northwest. Not so much a big fan of the gray wetness anymore, but I do feel right at home.
It takes getting used to. I grew up like that in Sweden, so I'm pretty accustomed to it. But the summers are great. It's like, you know, maybe too dry, but you don't at all get the precipitation that you get.
I tell people the summers in the Pacific Northwest are incomparable. Just that you have to pay for it for the other 10 months of the year.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, and unless you have a real bad like fire season, which sucks as well.
That's true. Yeah, and of course over here on the east side of the Cascades, it's a lot drier.
Yeah,
I'm on the west side, or I grew up on the west side, where it's much wetter.
Yeah,
or much more wet. So,
yeah, you were telling me earlier here before we started up, like about the demographic shifts you've seen in your town where you grew
absolutely
up and stuff.
Yeah,
and,
like, absolutely.
Just how crazy that is and how fast it goes. I mean, we're talking about a couple of decades, and actually, when you were talking about that, it reminded me very much about the situation in Sweden as well. Same thing there. Late 80s, early 90s, very few migrants. There wasn't many, non-Europeans in my school, you know, where I was growing up. But then eventually, just over time, boom, boom, a couple of decades is just completely transformed.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
It was a disaster.
Yeah. I think, you know, like I was telling you, my high school graduating class, by the time I graduated from high school in the 90s, I think we had maybe, you know, 8 or 10, 15 Hispanics, somewhere around there, out of a class of 220, 230. But most of the growing up, it was virtually all white kids, you know, almost completely. A couple adopted Asians, one black girl, maybe an Hispanic, and then, like, you know, hundreds of white kids. And that's literally, you know, it was white bread, 99.5%, you know, white America, coal mining town, power, you know, electrical, you know, power plant town, Little League.
Any industry left there on that front at all?
Not too much. The power plant is still there. I think they shut down the mine, or they're shutting it down. I'm not exactly sure, but it's not operating like it used to be. And a lot of those jobs have gone. You know, it used to be, a lot of my friends growing up, their dads worked at the mine or at the power plant.
Yeah.
But then over time, when the more environmental regulations came and they were shutting things down, things became more expensive, you know, and they downsized, a lot of those people moved away.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, Weyerhaeuser used to be there. I don't think it's there anymore. And, you know, so that really gutted the community of real jobs, of real family jobs. And so it's sort of a, you know, in large degree, it's a lot of retirees and old people, and then a lot of new, basically Mexicans, Hispanics, Central Americans.
Yeah.
You know how that goes.
Yep. That's how they like it. Yeah. You know, Okay, so why don't we dive in a little bit to the JFK stuff here?
Absolutely.
Obviously. I mean, it's some. So there's like 2,000 somewhat PDFs that were released, and much of this. Now, there's some things resurfacing again that has been out before, but obviously it's gaining traction again because people think it's like, oh, this is part of the, you know, the release or whatever. But this is not looking too good for Israel, is it? A lot of redacted documents that actually shows that there was no objection by the CIA at the time to release the documents. However, there was a couple of things we got to redact. And, of course, that's like the Israeli intelligence services, the Mossad, any reference to Israel and stuff like that. And so this has been coming out over the last couple of days. What do you think of it? What do you make
of
it?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I guess I'm not surprised. You know, it's like you said, the only thing it seems, I've seen many documents now, people are producing many, finding many documents where there seemed to have been no objection to this document except for what's in brackets, and what is in brackets in all of these documents, Israeli intelligence, Mossad, Israel, Zionist conspiracy, Zionists, Jews, you know, this seems to be the only stuff that was objected to in any of these documents. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, there's 80,000 of them. People, you know, it's going to take a long time to go through them.
Yes. Yeah.
And, it's sort of like whatever your pet theory is, you're probably going to find something in this document dump that supports your theory. If you think it's Israel, you're going to find evidence for that. If you think it was just the CIA, listen, you're going to find a lot of CIA stuff in here. If you think it was LBJ or the mob, you're probably going to find that stuff too. But this is what I tell people. You know, there's some explanatory power if you say the mafia killed JFK. And the reason why that theory's never really died is because there's some explanatory power there. There were mafia and mob elements that were involved, right?
Of course. Yeah.
And then, of course, when you get the LBJ angle, the Lyndon Johnson angle, that's going to have some explanatory power too, because he was involved, especially with the cover-up later. I'm not certain that he was involved on the front end. Definitely think he was involved on the back end.
Yeah.
So there's some explanatory power there as well. And then if you look at the CIA, obviously, you know, we're going to get into, you know, James Angleton and some of the CIA connections to this assassination. So there's some explanatory power there as well. So there's been all these competing theories. Was it LBJ? Was it the mob? Was it the CIA? And that's sort of where they've kept us for decades, arguing over, like, you know, which one of these factions was it? Well, it was – once you understand that it was Israel – then you start to see how Israel sort of sits down on top of those things and connects them all together. Israel working
that's
through
what lays the puzzle. All those, you know, disconnected dots.
That's what
dots,
connects
you know,
all the. Yeah. That's what connects
the Star of David.
Exactly. That's what connects all the dots, right? You know, because they were, you know, Lyndon Johnson was connected to a lot of Jews and the Jewish lobby, as it was called back then. Not the
Israeli
lobby. Did
you hear that his mom, like three generations back, supposedly?
I know about that, and it's dicey because it's like some people say it is, some people say no. So, but he definitely was a friend of the Jews, and we know that he was the first sitting president to dedicate a synagogue, and that was in Texas, literally 6 weeks after the assassination. So, and he was. Maybe we'll get into more of that, but he was quite the friend to Israel. He reversed all of JFK's anti-Israel policies and pro-Arab policies. He reversed those as well. And, you know, so you know, it was Israel working through its Jewish mob ties, through its agents in the CIA, and with Lyndon Johnson. So it connects everything. It really brings the whole picture into focus.
Yeah, because again, I mean, you pay someone to pull the trigger, you know,
right? Like,
who's providing the money, right?
Right.
I
show
that one document.
And whose plan is it? Who's got the motivation?
Yeah.
Who's got the motive? Right. Who's the move? Who's the mover? Who's got the motion?
Yeah.
And like you said, they can pay a trigger man, which they did.
And
you know, Corey Hughes has done a lot of great work on this, identifying a couple of the trigger men. One of them was Jack Valenti, and the other one I think was David Ferry. And there could be some others. You know, my memory fails me, but if anybody wants to learn more about that, you can, you know, go to Corey Hughes' website. Site or watch any of his presentations, but he's really nailed a lot of it down. But even he says David Ben-Gurion was at the top of that that totem pole.
Yeah, part of that was because of course Dimona, right?
The nuclear facility.
And what was it?
There were actually several motives that the Israelis had. Obviously, they were trying to build their nuclear program. They were trying to obtain a nuclear weapon, and JFK, we know, was having, you know, had this fight with them. A lot of letters back and forth and communications back and forth with David Ben-Gurion. And finally, JFK actually in July 1963 gave David Ben-Gurion an ultimatum, basically. And instead of receiving the letter, David Ben-Gurion chose to resign. And then his successor came, and they sort of had to restart the talks. Well, really, it was a delay tactic to give them a chance to delay the inspections of the nuclear program and give them time to assassinate JFK. But, you know, they had other motives as well. JFK was trying to register the Jewish lobby, as it was known back then. We call it the Israeli lobby now, but it was back then it was known as the Jewish lobby. And
specifically the American Zionist Council.
The American Zionist Council, the forerunner of AIPAC.
Yep.
And they were, and in fact, Bobby, his brother, the Attorney General of the United States, had delivered the paperwork, and the paperwork for registering as foreign agents under FARA was on the desk of the Jewish lobbies, the American Zionist Council's legal representation. They had the paperwork. They were in process of getting it signed in return and registering. That was deep sixed. It was Lyndon Johnson dropped that whole process immediately after JFK was assassinated.
Yeah.
But there was more, so that was another motive, right? The other motive was, the other major motive was JFK was pushing for Palestinian right of return. He was actually lobbying for it at the United Nations. In fact, 2 days before he was assassinated, he had the American diplomats at the United Nations reintroduce a UN resolution 1994, 1994, calling for the Palestinian right of return. He had them place it back on the UN docket, their official business. And he had promised the leaders of the surrounding Arab countries that he was going to get that done. And that the Palestinians, some 800,000 of them who had been displaced in the Nakba, were going to be able to get to return into their lands and homes.
Yeah, I mean, that'll do it. And again, put that in historical context. What were they doing? I mean, the time when JFK gets assassinated, Israel is, what, not even two decades old, right?
They were 15 years old.
Something like that. Yeah. They're founded on terrorism by terrorists.
The
Irgun, the Lehi, and stuff like that, right?
The Stern Gang.
Stern Gang is another one. They had bombed the King David Hotel when it was the British Mandate back in 48, something like that.
July 1948.
You had, of course, the assassination of the Swedish diplomat Folke Bernadotte, who was also appointed by the UN, right? And he had saved like 300 or 400 Danish Jews or something like
right,
that. Like,
yes, he'd rescued many Jews.
Exactly. Like, we're going to help you. This, you know, I genuinely want peace. Let's resolve this. No, they were just like, no, man, you're out.
Yeah.
Then of course you have this is later, but you know, this is to show you that they're not only willing to assassinate and murder and kill others or blackmail people. We'll get into that, but it's also they kill their own.
They will kill
if they stand in their way, right? Yitzhak Rabin.
That's a great example. You know, Yitzhak Rabin probably quarterbacked the assassination. He was in Dallas the day JFK was assassinated, and we know that because his wife wrote about it in his biography.
Yeah,
and she's like, basically, she presents it as, "Wow, wild coincidence." You know, the one day we're in Dallas, we get back home and we find out that JFK has been shot, and you know, you're like, you know, and then right after that, he was promoted to the Army Chief of Staff, the IDF Chief of Staff, I believe. Right, like, what's that about? Well, he got this big promotion right after the assassination of JFK, right after he was secretly in Dallas. Nobody knew it for many, many years, you know, that he was there. And then, of course, in the 1990s, he was assassinated because he put Israel on track for a two-state solution with Palestine.
Exactly.
So the hardcore, you know, Zionists are like, no, we're not having a two-state solution. We're not going to give the Palestinians any foothold back in their lands. So they whacked him, too. So it's like, you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Yep.
We saw it on 10/7 with the mass Hannibal protocol, where the IDF massacred hundreds of their own people to keep them from, you know,
To blame it on Hamas. Or use that as the excuse.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
This is what we got there. Was it 40 babies in the ovens?
40 beheaded babies, the babies in the ovens, you know,
The same outrage porn in order to drive that. But, you know, again, and these are, you know, history lessons we have to take into account. But, I mean, just look at the history between, specifically Netanyahu, and it doesn't stop there. Obviously, a lot of people are criticizing him, and for good reason. But, of course, this is an ethnic, religious agenda, essentially.
And most of the country's on board now. They're completely behind the war effort, the greater Israel effort, and they want to completely expel the Palestinians and be well on the road towards the Third Temple in greater Israel.
That's right.
There's broad consensus now. That's why they've torn up the ceasefire. They're reinvading. They're going at it.
Yes, I wanted to show a headline there, of course, where basically the PLO at the time, Yasser Arafat, was very popular, secular Arab, you know, nationalist movement. But of course, they needed a wedge to drive between them. So it was easy to prop up. Now, Israel, Netanyahu at the time, they didn't found the Hamas, right? But they funded them. Here's a quote from Haaretz piece here. Anyone who wants to thwart the establishment of a Palestinian state has to support bolstering Hamas and transferring money to Hamas. Remember, this is the Qatar diversion, right? Of like, yeah. Oh, Qatar, they're behind. I mean, we saw that, you know, surfacing among a lot of these Jewish activists on X recently.
If you oppose Israel in any, you know, if you have a, you know, any sort of decent platform or voice opposing Israel now, their favorite thing to do is accuse you of taking Qatari money.
Yeah,
but they're the ones that have been funneling money through Qatar to Hamas. So well, it's, you know, every accusation is a confession, right? You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, man, there's another clip that was that on Tucker.
In fact, they sent Mossad, like the head of the Mossad, to I forget which one, to Qatar to keep the money flowing to Hamas.
Yeah, it was sanctioned. They wanted them to do it. They wanted to set up. They wanted Qatar to set up diplomatic channels with Hamas.
Yes.
And I mean, of course, that's because you know then they can tap that. They can. You know, I get that. But again, going back to the article there, right? This was at a Likud Party Knesset meeting, essentially, back in 2019. So that's fairly late, but there's evidence of them, of course, supporting them way back when.
Right.
This is part of our strategy, Netanyahu said, to isolate the Palestinians in Gaza from the Palestinians in the West Bank. So they used this as a wedge issue and realized that it could become a more religiously extreme group, and now they can, you know, they can talk about the ties not only to Qatar but to Iran, obviously, right. Where this is ultimately all of this leading there. This right. Is Iran the last nation standing in Wesley Clark's little five countries,
seven nations in five years?
That's
Iran's the last to go.
Yeah. So we'll see. I think they're ramping up to that, to be honest. Here's a clip to underline you what you said there regarding the letters between Ben-Gurion and JFK at the time. This is the Martin Sandler. I think that's Jewish, right? The letters of John F. Kennedy. Look at this.
There's a very surprising series of letters between Kennedy and David Ben-Gurion, not only the prime minister, premier of Israel, but the founder of Israel, in which they're very angry letters in which Kennedy is saying to Ben-Gurion, I'm killing myself trying to get a nuclear test ban treaty. I've even got De Gaulle on board, and that's impossible. And you keep testing in Dimona. You've got to stop. And Ben-Gurion, thank you, in so many words says, it's easy for you to say sitting in Hyannisport. I'm sitting with the Arabs all around me, and you want me to give up nuclear testing. And Kennedy threatens him. And he threatens him in such a way that Ben-Gurion resigns. And I will tell you that I found articles, not in any crackpot publications, but in very sophisticated publications saying, forget Lyndon Johnson, forget the CIA, forget Fidel Castro. The Mossad killed Kennedy because they were so upset over what he did to Ben-Gurion. So, you know, we got a few little bombshells we throw in there, not proven.
Yes, I hear you.
All right, there you go. And of course, as you said before, you can throw in all those things as well, because there's also intricately involved pieces in the puzzle.
That's right.
LBJ, and of course, then you have the Zionist issue that we talked about.
Angleton at the CIA.
Angleton, yeah. I mean, he's an interesting, very interesting character, and we're wondering here, like, what was his motivation, right? Like, why did he do this? He's his mother was born in Mexico. Her last name was Morano. Some people have said that's a kind of a play, right? That's a common Sephardic Jewish surname. So some people said maybe there's a Jewish connection. Is that what he got out of this? Or is it a blackmailing type of operation? He was actually born in Boise, Idaho, this guy. And I think his father is Anglo or something, I think. But anyway, very interesting character. He was a counterintelligence operative at the time. And of course, there's some famous, photos together with Mossad Global Operations head there, Mir Amit, at the time. This is 1966.
And I love the cowboy boots and cowboy hat. My fellow Americans, fellow white people, right?
Isn't he doing the meme because people said, look, it's not Israeli politicians going to America to dress up in a cowboy hat. It's actually American politicians going to the wall, humping. Right?
He's actually
doing the
thing. It's interesting you break that up, because I actually have some posts about that. I'm like, when was the last time you saw, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu put on a cowboy hat and go kiss the Washington Monument and pledge allegiance to George Washington, is Israel like the lapdog of the United States, or is the United States the lapdog of Israel? Well, I submit that, you know, the United States is the lapdog of Israel.
Yes.
But so that is funny, because here we got the head of the Mossad there, Meir Amit, wearing the cowboy hat coming to America.
I'm on your side.
Right.
But I don't think he needed to do that, because Angleton seems to be very happy to do their bidding. Let me see. There was a couple.
He seemed to be very happy, at least. And if he wasn't happy, he did it. Either way, he did it.
Exactly. And the end result of that has been disastrous.
Look, from 1951 to 1974, James Angleton was the head of the Israel desk for the CIA,
yes.
Meaning that he was the only representative of American intelligence that was authorized to officially talk to Israeli intelligence. So for 23, 24, almost 25 years, he was literally the single point of communication between American intelligence and Israeli intelligence, a single point of failure. And from 1961 to 1974, he operated without any supervision or oversight whatsoever at all. And that's because Alan Dulles had been the director of the CIA. He's the one that had appointed James Angleton to be the director of counterintelligence at the CIA.
Yeah.
And Kennedy fired Alan Dulles and Alan Dulles' two deputy directors in 1961. But he left James Angleton in place. Big mistake, JFK. You left the guy that ended up, you know. And when that happened, that left Angleton free rein. He didn't have any oversight anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he was everything that he was doing and carrying on doing, nobody knew anything about. When they finally were able to oust him in 1974, the CIA discovered that he had 40 secret vaults, 40. 40 secret vaults that they had to drill open, by the way. It took them 3 years to catalog the contents of these vaults and another 6 years to write up the reports of their findings. And those findings are summarized in 12 legal-sized volumes that still have never been released.
Well, of course not. You know, what do you think? What do you make of the release at all? I felt it was a little bit of this, like, the Epstein files, mm-hmm. not even the correct term. We just want a client list, right? But
right.
Anyway, fine.
Right.
That was a dud, and they're like, what's going on? What happened? Okay, well, fine, give them something, you know, kind
right.
of thing. And they're like, all right, just push those out. And it's like, did they forget to redact the things? What do you think they're doing?
I think because it's so voluminous, and there's so much information in there, and because you can find proof in there for any whatever your pet theory is, I think it's just going to blow over. Because listen, we already had enough information to implicate Israel.
I agree.
We already knew that. So,
yeah.
So more files. It's just gonna. It's like more sauce for the goose, right? We already had enough sauce for the goose. So now we just got more sauce for the goose. And you know, in today's 24-hour news cycle, they've practically already moved past it. You know,
It goes very fast.
It goes very true. So look, people are like already sort of past the Epstein files, and now we got the JFK files done. And what happened? Nothing. Nothing's happened.
Well,
and,
you know, one you thing know, they can do. That's to monitor everyone who's complaining about Israel and making the link so the GROK
right.
can build profiles on people
yes.
who are anti-Semites so you can target them later.
Well, and that's no joke. They're already doing that in the universities, right?
They
but,
are,
you know,
yeah.
they like to
yeah.
land and expand. You know, they're not going to stop there. You know, we have anti-BDS laws in 38 U.S. states. A BDS law stands for Boycott, Divest, Sanction. And this is a movement to try to hamstring, you know, Israel's tyranny. Let's boycott companies from that do business in Israel. Let's divest ourselves from companies that are operating in Israel, and let's sanction Israel or boycott. Right. So this is a movement. It's freedom of association. Any person can decide who they're going to buy products from or not buy products from, who they're going to invest in, who they're not going to invest in. But in 38 U.S. states, there are laws on the books that say if you participate in the BDS movement, you can't do business with the government. You can't qualify for disaster aid relief, like in Texas or Florida or Tennessee or these places that have floods and tornadoes and hurricanes. If your property gets damaged or wiped out, you don't qualify for disaster relief aid unless you sign this piece of paper saying that you won't participate in BDS and that you pledge allegiance to Israel and you will never boycott Israel or criticize Israel. 38 states. It started with one state, and now it's expanded to 38, and I think more states are probably going to start or eventually going to come on board. Meanwhile, it's legal to criticize America. It's legal to boycott America. It's legal to
burn American flags.
Burn American flag. But if you do any of that towards Israel, that's illegal or against the law, or at the very, you know, you can get kicked out of college now. You can get deported out of college now.
Yeah.
Out of the country, or you're going to be ineligible to do business or qualify for disaster relief aid.
This is overplaying their hand, though, I got to say. Isn't this too obvious to be
honest? I mean, you would think, but yet more and more states are coming on board. Just last year, Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, signed another anti-BDS bill in South Dakota. There's 300 Jews in South Dakota and no synagogues.
Yeah, yeah.
How do their interests outweigh the interests of all the South Dakotans?
Yeah, it's the legal authority, I guess, that carries, right?
That's
they're like,
right.
look, this is illegal. You can't do any of that here.
Yeah.
Of course, meanwhile, you have decades of anti-white hate on these college campuses. You have cultural Marxism running rampant, anti-Americanism, anti-colonialism.
Anti-whiteism, anti-Christianism.
Everything. You know, like they've just gone after white people in every capacity that they can. Americans of European heritage, and now this is a bridge too far with this, with these pro-Palestinian protests. It's just, I mean, it's so blatant, right? Yeah. That I feel that this is just, I don't think this is helping them. That's my point. This is not helping.
It's going to have a Streisand effect, a blowback effect, hopefully sooner rather than later.
I hope you're right. Yeah, I was going to pull up that. Here's a classic, right? The Harvard Magazine. This is Noel Ignatieff. But there's so many of these examples.
Right.
But like, just, yeah, abolish the white race. There was no shutting down because of this. There was no targeting of these professors or the people in the schools that supported this, the students or whatnot, you know?
You know, it's interesting, Henrik. When you post about this, I post about this on Twitter a lot, you know? And I'll get, you know, non-white people jumping into my reply saying, what anti-whiteism on campus? There's no anti-whiteism on campus. And I'm like, well, what's this?
Yeah. Yep. It's right in the open.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we have, what's a passage there? Let's go back to Angleton for a moment.
Right.
The Goy and the Golem, James Angleton and the Rise of Israel. It says here, this is from a book by Jefferson Morley. And this might be very...
It's his biographer.
Is that what it is? Okay, yeah. There you go. Okay, yeah, he said... Angleton was a leading architect of America's strategic relationship with Israel that endures and dominates the region to this day. He goes on to say here, Israel's shift from an embattled settler state into a strategic ally of the world's greatest superpower, and what an ally it is, right? Angleton did so chiefly by barring any effort in the U.S. intelligence establishment to question Israel's acquisition of nuclear weapons in the 1960s. We're back to the Kennedy stuff here, obviously, right? Angleton's loyalty to Israel betrayed U.S. policy on an epic scale, Morley writes. Instead of supporting U.S. nuclear security policy, he ignored it on behalf of Israel.
That's correct.
Right? So it's just screw the actual office and the oath you took to that office. It's just all about Israel. Right?
I mean, people don't know about this, but you can look up the Apollo affair or NUMEC, N-U-M-E-C, and Israel stole 600 pounds of highly enriched weapons-grade uranium from the United States.
Was that 1960s. Is that like Pennsylvania or Ohio?
In Apollo, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right.
And Zalman Shapiro was the head of that nuclear plant.
We're just making it up.
You know? I know, it's just crazy. It's just, you know. But you know, that happened under Angleton's watch, along with the theft of nuclear secrets and nuclear technology and nuclear weapons-grade material. That all happened under his watch. He covered it up, and that was in direct contravention to United States nuclear policy.
Yeah. Let's see. Is this the one here? No, that's mine. I'm trying to find the little commemorative stone that Angleton got in by the King David Hotel. Right. And that's another bomb. I did mention that bombing. Yeah. That's right. But he got a little plaque there, I guess.
When he died in 1987, they had a memorial service for him in Israel, and they gave him a little rock, a little plaque. And the current heads of the Shin Bet and the Mossad were there. All of the past heads of the Mossad and the Shin Bet were there. The defense minister at the time, Yitzhak Rabin, was there, and many other dignitaries. And they called him a friend to Israel, and they gave him a nice little memorial service.
Well, wonderful. Isn't that wonderful? I think this is the one. Now I can pull it up now. I think it's on X, but anyway.
Yeah.
These are very interesting, and you know, we talked about his mother.
And meanwhile, and by the way, Henrik, does anybody in the United States even know who this guy is? For the most part, Americans don't know who this
conspiracy
guy is.
Conspiracy theories. They're the only ones who ever heard James Angleton.
Israelis know who he is. He's got a memorial over there. He doesn't have a memorial here. He's got a memorial over there.
That's right. You know? Exactly. No, this is what it tells you. This is the same thing when, Robert Maxwell, royally received after his yacht incident, whatever actually happened there. But he's buried right on the prime real estate on the Mount of Olives.
Right.
He's a great hero. Pollard, he comes back, he's bending down and kissing the landing strip there in front of Netanyahu. He gets a hero's welcome, these people, you know what I mean? And so he's kind of fitting into that mold
he
as
does.
Well.
Because that's a good point.
When you talk about, you know, CIA, which people bring up in these documents, like, oh, the CIA did it kind of thing. Like, there is no distinction there between the Mossad and the CIA. It's the same thing. That's how I view it, anyway. It's the same agenda, basically.
And basically, when you hear the CIA killed JFK, you need to think James Angleton, the head of CIA counterintelligence. Basically, Israel killed JFK with the help of their guy inside the CIA.
Yes.
So, was there CIA complicity? Well, yeah, kind of, but it wasn't like a CIA plot. And not only that, but you know, he was famous for running a CIA within the CIA.
Yeah.
He didn't, like I said, he didn't have any supervision. Nobody knew what he was doing. Nobody knew what was going on. He was there for 25 years running his own little thing. He was famous for conducting mole hunts.
Yeah.
And never
yeah.
finding anything. And creating all sorts of chaos within the agency. They were constantly firing people and cutting spies loose because he said these were moles, we couldn't trust them. And meanwhile, he was the guy that was the mole. I mean, it's like this is the kind of stuff you see in Hollywood movies, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of that, maybe we'll get to that later.
Right?
Yeah. There's some interesting things there. Let me see. Should we play some of Ben Shapiro's takes here?
Sure.
This is the most important stuff. But it is funny when Ben rears his head and he's going to like, we'll get into JFK later. Here's one of them, right? Ben Shapiro's JFK file take is wild. Let's listen to this.
Sort of conspiracy theorizing that's become incredibly popular on the right these days. It was popular on the left, and now it's become increasingly popular on the right. The kind of, let's just ask questions. Who really killed JFK? Wink, wink, nod, nod. And then you're like, well, do you have any evidence of the thing that you are presupposing? Well, no, I'm not making any accusations. I just know I don't believe the story that I'm being told. I know not to trust the authorities. You're like, well, that's fine, but do you have, like, any evidence? Like, evidence, not just supposition. I said, well, you're part of it, aren't you? You're part of it. The reason that you're so defensive about all this is, I don't care who killed JFK. I mean, I do, because it's really interesting. But I noticed that the calendar says 2025, and he was killed in 1963. And so my opinion about who killed JFK has about as much relevance as who killed William McKinley, or James Garfield, which is to say, not an enormous amount.
All right. By the way, don't notice who killed William McKinley. I'm just going to say it. If for all of you people who notice patterns, yes, the same.
Yes, he is.
The assassin of James McKinley. Yes, he is.
But this is not relevant. You know, this is, it's kind of fine. But yeah, I don't really care who killed the president or for what reason. Well, if you're covering for it like this, Ben, then you're part of the problem, obviously. And that's why people are calling. They are on the defensive about this, which is kind of fun to see.
Right.
To be honest. But you did a good clip on here. Like, well, bro, it's 2025. Just let it go, okay? Because who cares? It was a long time ago. Listen to this.
They talk about the USS Liberty incident. I have to say I'm a little bit bewildered why you're so obsessed with an incident that is now 52 years old. If you have theories that are better than those of the American government, they've got operators standing by. Feel free to dial them and tell them about your five-decade-old theories about a military incident from the 1967 Six-Day War. It's of direct and vital interest now in 2019. I don't care who killed JFK. I mean, I do, because it's really interesting. But I noticed that the calendar says 2025, and he was killed in 1963. And so my opinion about who killed JFK has about as much relevance as who killed William McKinley, or James Garfield, which is to say, not an enormous amount.
A few moments later.
According to the Bible and certain interpretations of contemporaneous archaeology, Joshua entered the land of Israel in 1400 BC. The kingdom of David was founded around 1000 BC. The first temple of Solomon was built in approximately 957 BC.
Yeah, but was it though? And who cares? Because it's such a long time ago.
I mean, that was longer than 60 years ago.
Yes,
right. By my math.
But you know, it's only what's interesting to me and what's important to me and my ethnic group that's important, right? Yeah. So anyway, yeah, that's what they do. They cover and they lie and the deceit and they muddy the waters and you know,
You know what's interesting? They've delayed the release of the USS Liberty files again recently. Just like back in December, a judge decided to keep them sealed and not release them. So,
wonder what else? Same thing there, really. What else do you need to know?
Right. Well, I mean, what's that issue
details
is what, you know,
course,
you know, why did Israel attack the USS Liberty and try to sink it? And that's a sort of source of great controversy. Well, those files might shed light.
I think Al Jazeera documentary made it clear when the tapes were out.
I think it's pretty clear, but there are ways to shoot holes in some of that. And Al Jazeera took some liberties. And so there's still some controversy. And nobody really knows for sure why. Everybody knows Israel attacked Liberty. They don't deny it. They say it was some say it was an accident. Some say it was this. Some say it was that. Nobody knows for sure who ordered the attack or why. And that would be what maybe is in the files now, but we don't know because they've ordered them to remain sealed for the next however long, right? So, you know, so we got the Epstein files they're not releasing. You got the Liberty files that they're not releasing. Seth Rich, the Democrat operative, right? When Bernie was running for president, if you're noticing, Seth Rich is Jewish. Most people don't know that. You know, Bernie Sanders, Jewish. Seth Rich was killed, you know, obviously, I think assassinated. And they recently, a couple weeks ago, they decided to keep those files sealed too.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, if they'd kept the JFK files sealed, so, you know, Liberty files sealed, Epstein files sealed, Seth Rich files sealed.
Too much.
The Kennedy files sealed. Yeah. I mean, like, what's the connection here? Gotta, like, what do they all have in common,
they
you know?
They got to give us something, right?
Something.
So this is like, all right, fine. We'll, you know, we'll let him have it.
Yeah.
Let him spin it for a while. We'll just map who the anti-Semites are. And then we'll,
right, yes.
What's it called? Operation Esther, or what is it?
Esther, Operation Esther.
Project 2025.
Project Esther,
right?
Yeah.
They are, you know, sometimes I'm wondering about that. You're on X and stuff, and you're like, you know, how do I put this? I think this is an area of interest to a lot of people, and I also think there's a lot of people that do genuinely care about this. However, certain things and certain topics, it feels to me, just like this, the instinctual response that I get is like, is this boosted to make it, you know how they hid the likes,
yes,
for example, right? To
yes,
kind of to make people feel more comfortable about liking stuff that they otherwise wouldn't do, for example.
And that's other thing is they have massive bot operations. And now they can hide the bot operations because you can't see who's liking stuff. You can't see where all those likes are coming from. You can't see they're coming from bot farms.
Right, exactly.
And obviously Twitter controls the bots, and the companies that are supposed to control the bots on Twitter are Israeli-based companies.
Yeah.
And so you have Israeli-based companies that are authenticating, allegedly, you know, blue-check verified users and are supposed to control the bot swarm on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time that they implemented that, they implemented, we're going to hide the likes. So, like, you know, do the math. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but Ben Shapiro and a lot of these Zionists who have been spent the last year and a half getting ratioed since October 7th, all of a sudden aren't getting ratioed as hard anymore. And they're getting a lot more
interesting
likes.
Interesting. Yeah, there you go.
You know, I'm not sure what that's all about.
Because it's kind of I see the popular with the pro-Israeli crowd and then the anti-Israeli crowd. It's a lot of traffic on those topics,
yes,
obviously, right?
Absolutely.
And I'm like, is that artificial? Is it to drive that to, like, kind of pull people out of the woodwork on that topic?
Yes.
To make, it's even this weird, like, inorganic. Remember that, like, this, what, a couple of weeks ago now, where, like, a number of these kind of, not maybe the kind of the upper crust of the conservative influencers, but, like, kind of, well, them and some below them, who are just like this. Does Israel stuff have to stop? And oh, the anti-Semitism is crazy. And it was almost like this. I think it was Richard Hanian that initially made a tweet. It was like, they're gonna find you, or so, like, they're gonna map and track you guys, and you better back off of this
right,
topic.
Yeah.
It was something to that effect. And I was like, and then you see all these kind of people all of a sudden, like, take this clear kind of stance that, like, this is unacceptable with anti-Semitism and shit like
well,
that.
Well, I think obviously they do boost anti-Semitism, and they're on record. Many Jews are on, and organizations are on record as, like, you know, we need to boost anti-Semitism. Even Theodor Herzl, one of the, you know, the founding, you know, Zionist in modern times, said we have to utilize anti-Semitism to galvanize our people, to motivate our people, right? To, you know, to enhance that tribal nature and motivate them to adopt Zionism. And, you know, they fundraise off it too, like the ADL has an interest in driving anti-Semitism because it scares their people. They open up their checkbooks and their wallets and their credit cards and their bank accounts, and they donate to these Jewish organizations that then lobby the government, like AIPAC, you know, or the ADL or the American Zionist, the World Zionist Congress, you know, the World Jewish Congress, you know, the Zionist Organization of America, the Jewish Federation of North America. All these organizations get money and get donations from their members, and then they go lobby Congress and governments and buy favor, right? You know, so they are driving it. They are doing it on purpose. I do believe some of it's elevated, but, you know, they only elevate certain voices and certain messaging, Henrik.
I think that's true, right? And I think we'll see. I mean, I don't say that to, like, scare anyone away from it. I'm just, like, noticing the kind of almost an artificial drive of the topic. And it does, as you said, it's a double-edged sword in that sense. You have to, you have to expose the truth. You have to talk about this. You have to talk about what in terms of, like, why can't America, get off its knees, essentially. Like, what's the problem? Why is it being held down? Who's using it, right? And that, of course, that has consequences on Europe. It has consequences of what's happening in Ukraine with all these neoconservatives and the Zionists and the proxy war against Russia, all this stuff, right? So it's like a downward, kind of a domino effect. You got to expose it, but then at the same time, you realize, they can kind of benefit on that. But if they can do, I mean, look, as we said before, they bomb their own people, right?
Right.
I mean, here's an example from 1950, where it was Zionists attacked Iraqi Jews. They bombed them in order to get them to migrate to Israel.
And they did this throughout the Middle East. I think they did it in Morocco. And then, of course, you have the Levant affair in Egypt, where they recruited Egyptian Jews who posed as Muslims to bomb British and American civilian targets along these lines, to create a false flag, to blame it on Islamic terrorism, and probably to scare Egyptian Jews into going to Israel.
Yeah.
And there it is, right? And this is confirmed. We know that they did this, to be honest, a lot of these countries, the Jews have been living there for a long time. They had perfectly fine relationships in many of these Arab countries for a long time, and they weren't moving to Israel.
Yeah.
Israel needed them to come. And so what do? You create terrorist attacks that scare them into coming to Israel. But
yeah,
they were false flags.
Indeed. Exactly. So there's a couple of, what is that even? We could play this clip that's kind of interesting. It has to do with the, so I can find that real quick. I think it was this Truman also? Just a dilemma of this time and period. And of course, Britain this goes back to Romans had a problem here, and that the British has a problem here. Then eventually America gets, but now it's a problem. It's always a problem, right? But anyway, right. Listen to Truman here.
We had several other people in the country, even among the Jews, the Zionists particularly, who were against anything that was to be done if they couldn't have the whole of Palestine and everything handed to them on a silver plate so they wouldn't have to do anything. It couldn't be done. We had to take it in small doses. You can't move 5 or 6 million people out of a country and fill it up with 5 or 6 million more and expect both sets of them to be pleased.
49.
But don't think that decision to recognize Israel is an easy one. I had to make a compromise with the Arabs and divide Palestine. The Jews wanted to chase all the Arabs into the Tigris and Euphrates River, and the Arabs wanted to chase all the Jews into the Red Sea. And what I was trying to do was to find a homeland for the Jews and still be just with the Arabs.
Yeah, make everyone happy, which is impossible in this
case. What's interesting?
They don't want a two-state solution. They want a one-state solution.
What's interesting about that? Nobody knew it at the time. We know now. One of those Israeli terrorist gangs, I think it was, I don't know if it was the Irgun Stern or Lehi. I think it was the Lehi. I could be wrong. They actually sent letter bombs to Truman to try to assassinate him. And he had Jewish money behind him as well by that time. So that's some context that, he was doing that somewhat under duress. They tried to assassinate him.
Yeah.
And they successfully assassinated his Secretary of Defense, Admiral James Forrestal, who had been the Secretary of the Navy. They made him the first Secretary of Defense, and he was assassinated. He opposed the creation of Israel.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
That was in 1948. Yeah.
Let me play this too. This is going back to the Hamas thing, but they talk about the universities and whoever, is a pro-Hamas and supports Hamas, they need to be, then deported out of the country, or at least they will lose their, position at the university or reprimanded in some kind of way. There's all these consequences now for it, right? But going back to the point you mentioned, what if you financially support Hamas? Is that a problem? Are you a terrorist now or whatnot? Here's a classic clip from Ron Paul talking about how, the United States, which of course, again, is in the pocket of Israeli interest here, but how they help out and support these types of groups. Listen to this.
If you look at the history, you'll find out that Hamas was encouraged and really started by Israel because they wanted Hamas to counteract Yasser Arafat. And you say, well, yeah, that was better then and it served its purpose, but we didn't want Hamas to do this. So then we as Americans say, well, we have such a good system, we're going to impose this on the world. We're going to invade Iraq and teach people how to be Democrats. We want free elections. So we encourage the Palestinians to have a free election. They do, and they elect Hamas. So we first indirectly and directly through Israel help establish Hamas. Then we have election. Then Hamas becomes dominant, so we have to kill them. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, it does kind of make sense, but
You know what's interesting? Nobody talks about this. When Hamas was voted into power in 2006, the real zeitgeist was the ruling party before Hamas was terrible. They were awful. And so the people were sort of ready for, we just want somebody You know, we understand that in America when, like, you know, Biden was awful and people was like, we got to get rid of these guys. We want that last administration out. So the party that was ruling before Hamas, they were terrible. They were awful. And Gaza's like, we just, you know, we want somebody new. And so that's point number one. Point number two, the majority of Palestinians did not vote for Hamas. Hamas won with the plurality. It was like only like 40-some% of the vote. And that was in 2006. If you fast forward, and that's the last time they've had an election, by the way. If you fast forward to now, about 50% of Gaza is children under 18.
Yes.
That means that if you take that means that the majority of Gazans now, over 50%, well over 50%, because remember, only 46% of voting age Gazans, assuming that 100% of them voted, only 46% of them voted for Hamas in 2006. Okay. Now you fast forward now, so you have like half the adult population voted for Hamas. And 50% of the population is kids who never voted. That means at least three quarters of Gaza now never voted for Hamas.
Right. Yeah.
And they say, well, this is what they voted for. And I'm like, actually, no, at least 75% of them never voted for this.
Yeah.
50% of them weren't even alive.
Yeah. And then, even if they did vote, like, what do you expect them to do?
Right.
Is the only ones that's fighting back. And it's like,
right.
They're being bombed, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And, I mean, again, the agenda here is clear. It's to drive them out of the region. I mean, they're like, oh, we should send them to Ireland and to, was it Norway, because they were supportive of an Palestinian state, right?
Right.
you guys need to take them in. They're too dangerous to keep around Jews, you see. But, yeah, you can
yeah.
You take
them. They're dangerous terrorists here, so yeah. You take them.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, this is the policy. You know, this is the Israeli lobby, and people have been exposing this for quite a while and kind of built this puzzle of what's going on, right? But, yeah, predominantly these are, Jewish neoconservatives that started that movement and then gone after a number of these countries, creating chaos all around the world, you know. And it's upwards of possibly as high as 60 million people have been displaced because of all these wars that they've created.
Crazy.
You know what I mean? So then you get mass immigration in the wake, and, you know, and people are like wondering, like, what's your beef with the Jewish activism or, like, you know, ethnic Jewish interests? And it's like, well, you know, you're like, you're literally screwing everything up here on behalf of your own, you know, what you think is good for you, you know. I'm very glad that some of this is being exposed now. And the question is if we can get it to a wide enough audience in due time. Because I'm not sure about you, Sam, but I kind of feel that they're panicking a little bit too. Like they feel that window is closing. And so
yes.
They're acting in a rash way. They're acting with hubris. They're like, when we get this done, we got to do it now.
They have the maximum control they've ever exercised over the American government right now. And they also have, you know, their support isn't going to get any bigger because they got the boomers still, but the boomers are dying. And the younger generations don't support Israel nearly as much as the boomers. So everything's coming to a head. They still have majority support in the government. They still control the government. They still got the boomers. They still got the Christian evangelicals and Zionists on their side. And everything's ramped up. All the military operations are ramped up. They got everybody. They got Syria. You know, they ousted Assad. They've taken over Syria. They've leveled Gaza. They're operating in the West Bank. They are now unified. They're on the same page. They're going for it right now. They don't want to like take a step back and stop and then have this problem keep going for more decades and decades and then having to solve it. They want to take, they've gone three quarters of the way now. They want to finish the job.
Yeah, they have to.
Yeah.
And of course now they have. I mean, there was technically more Jews in Biden's cabinet than there is in Trump's, but many of them are evangelical Zionists, you know. And
they're all radicals. All of them are radical Zionists. So it's, you know, so it's like, okay, they don't have to be Jewish because they support Jewish interests, and many of them have been allied with Jews and their organizations and received money from, like, Pete Hegseth. You know, he's got money from the Adelsons for his organizations that he's worked in. He's, you know, and he went to the King David Hotel, that hotel that the Jewish terrorists bombed, right? He went there and he called for the Jews to build a third temple, you know.
Yeah, he went to the actually the head rabbi of the Temple Institute, in fact.
Right.
I forget what his name is there. I should pull it up here. Yeah, Hegseth. Let me search for that real quick. He went there. He's supportive of the third temple. Here we go. Here's some tweets on this, right? Of course, this is before he became defense secretary, right? But still, here's the picture. Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense once toured the Al-Aqsa compound with Rabbi Chaim Richman. That's right, a U.S.-born Israeli rabbi who leads the Temple Institute, which is dedicated to destroying the Dome of the Rock and building a temple over its ruins to serve as the seat of Greater Israel's genocidal theocracy. There you go. Interesting. And he has a Hebrew tattoo of Yeshua on his arm, too, by the way. That's Pete Hegseth for you right there. Here's another one. He said here, says Trump's new pick for defense secretary says, if you open up your Bible, you'll find that God granted Abraham the land of Israel. And this should apparently inform our understanding of the modern Israeli-Palestine conflict. So he's aboard. He wants a third temple, this guy.
Which means destroying the Dome of the Rock, or the Al-Aqsa Temple, rather. And that would just ignite a firestorm throughout the entire Muslim Arab world.
Will it, though? I thought that some stuff that has happened already would. And the fact that it hasn't, maybe that was like, oh, that's it. They're racing the black battle flag on the dome. And like, well, who do they got?
They don't
have the Saudis. Yeah. They don't have the Qataris. They don't have the Iran. Is that the only one left?
maybe it won't. I think they are boiling the frog. Or they're warming up the frog in the pot. Maybe once they get to Al-Aqsa, maybe the will and the resistance of the Muslims will have been petered out, and they won't. Maybe they won't. So, but we'll see.
I think they'll at some point they're gonna like strike. You know,
yes,
I mean, they're gonna try. Or whoopsie,
red heifers are all about.
Yeah, you know? How do they breed them and shit? Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, they're gonna go right back to burning animals. So anyway, let's go back to the JFK stuff for a little bit. Obviously, interesting that Abraham Zapruder happened to be in the right, just in the right time at the right place.
Yeah, the only guy there with a camera filming the proceedings just happened to be perfectly positioned was a Jew whose offices were in the Daltex building.
That's right.
That shots came from.
Yep.
And his secretary was there with them, also Jewish.
I think they also wanted that footage to be able to show to coming presidents. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
If you don't do X, this is what's going to happen to you, basically, right? Because it was like the censored version was out for a long time, and then eventually, I forget when the gruesome.
I think the version we have now is still they've shown has been altered, like so there's a frame or two missing or something.
Oh, is it okay?
And I think it centers around maybe like where the shot comes from, like kind of obscures that perhaps.
Yeah.
But you know, the public didn't even know about the existence of this film. I think for many years, long time.
Yep.
So it was secret. I'll tell you another interesting anecdote. There was a man. He's known as Umbrella Man, and people, you can go look this up.
Yeah.
Umbrella Man.
Yeah.
It was a nice, sunny, blue sky, sunny, warm day in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, and there's one man there with an umbrella standing basically right at the point of the assassination. Turns out he's Jewish, too. And he said he was there to send a message.
Send a message with my umbrella. I think here's a – oh, that's small there. But
there
yeah.
it is.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Oh. Oh, gosh, you got to sign in. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, there it is. Umbrella Man, exactly. Yeah, they do.
I had a follower point out to me that kind of thing's perfect for a range card. For anybody who's a sniper or knows about shooting and your range card, like, you know,
like how big it is or something?
Well, so a range card tells you the distance to certain objects out of your shooting range. Like, you know, and so that allows you to adjust your scope and wind and sort of just, it gives you predetermined shot trajectories and scopings, right?
Right.
And that, I guess, you know, and you put this on your range card. So having a landmark, like a man with an umbrella, that's standing in a spot, you know, a predetermined spot, tells you this is exactly how far away that is, and so you know how far the car is away. You know how to make your sniper adjustments. So, you know, people get crazy about this. But listen, how many coincidences are we? You know, are you willing to tolerate? You know,
yeah, exactly. No, it's how you lay that puzzle, and it's like, well, that circumstance. Well, now you've put it all together, and what piece after that? Lay the puzzle. All right.
Yeah.
So the film there is obviously interesting too, right? JFK, because
right.
I mean, I forgot the obvious. We were doing a standing for Stu Peters actually, and it should be out later today. We talked about many of these things as well there, but I mentioned, of course, that Arnon Milchan, the Israeli spy, stepped in and funded the movie to, I forget if it ended up being 20 or 40 million, but he stepped in. He just had formed Regency Enterprises. He was very excited. He's going to have this big movie, whatever. And of course, they revised the script from like 190 some pages down to 150. The Warner Bros. Guy, Terry Semel, another Jewish guy, very excited about this. But then, of course, it turns out that you know, Oliver Stone, that's a taken name. Sam, here we go. It is Abraham Louis Silverstein, it turns out. I was like, how can I forget? How do I drop that one? But there you go. So these are the people that are producing then the conspiracies around this, right?
Right. And in this Cubans, movie, if you've watched this movie, they literally name everybody, the mob, the CIA, I think the Cubans. It's been a while. Yeah. They name everybody in this movie except Israel. No mention of Israel, no mention of Jews, no mention of Mossad, no mention of nothing, right, along those lines. And I'll tell you an anecdote. I was telling you this earlier, Henrik, but a lot of people don't know this. So Arnon Milchin produced it. He's an Israeli weapons trafficker and spy. Like, he was involved in Israel's nuclear program. So he knows that Israel was involved in the assassination of this guy knows, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he kept it completely out of the movie. But the man who did the PR for this movie, who promoted this movie, you know, every movie gets promoted, is a man named Frank Mankiewicz. Frank Mankiewicz was a member of the B'nai B'rith of the ADL. All right. And back in the 60s, he had been Bobby Kennedy's press secretary. In fact, he was Bobby Kennedy's press secretary in 1968. There he is, when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel right after winning the California primary in 1968. Bobby Kennedy famously exited the Ambassador Hotel through the pantry where Saran Saran was waiting for him to assassinate him, rather than exiting through the ballroom where all his excited followers were. And we now know, thanks to the research of Michael Collins Piper and testimony from people on the Bobby Kennedy campaign, that the person who suggested to Bobby that he exit through the pantry was none other than Frank Mankiewicz, his press secretary, who later did the promotion for the movie JFK.
Interesting. So it kind of comes together right there. And of course, then they had the Palestinian, right, for Sirhan.
Yeah,
Sirhan. And of course, Sirhan. You do have, yeah, we talked about it, but yeah, you do have the weird thing with the MKUltra stuff. And yeah. Again, look, was it not Angleton that helped to oversee some of that? Did I get that wrong?
I'm not sure what Angleton's involvement was with MKUltra, but I do know that it was run by a Jew named Sidney Gottlieb.
Yeah, Gottlieb.
And there was another a real high up principal, Jolly West. Who was also involved in MKUltra, another Jew, and Jolly West was involved with Jack Ruby, Jacob Rubenstein, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald,
the Patsy, right after, so he couldn't talk.
And Jolly West, you know, had visits with Jack Ruby, and they think that he did some sort of mind control something to Jack Ruby. Now, what's interesting about Sirhan Sirhan, he was a Palestinian Christian, and it looks like he was MKUltra. In fact, he's been examined by multiple psychiatrists since then, who say that he had been hypnotized beforehand. That there's evidence that his mind has been tampered with. And he doesn't have any recollection of the event, right?
Yeah, the girl in the polka dot dress, right? Like a handler, yeah. Someone who sexually gave you favors.
And you can go diving down. So Saran Saran, I almost guarantee, was an MK Ultra, okay?
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting, that was June 1968. 1 month previous, in May 1968, another Jewish psychiatrist in the U.S. Navy had helped hatch the plan that they were going to assassinate Yasser Arafat using an MK Ultra Palestinian to assassinate Yasser Arafat. That was a month beforehand. And so it's like you just the dots just keep connecting, you know.
Yeah, so I saw some posts say Palestinian executed or assassinated, you know, RFK. That's the that's your problem is the Palestinians,
right?
There's some very interesting connection. Yeah, I think it was Alan Dulles maybe was that oversaw MKUltra.
Alan Dulles, it may have hatched or began under him, but he was fired again in 1961 early on.
Maybe the guy who took over after him. I read it yesterday and his name escapes me. But regardless, this was when Angleton was in there. He was an underling.
From 51 to 74, that was James Angleton. Yeah. So the USS Liberty incident, the theft of our nuclear weapons technology and uranium, the assassinations of RFK and JFK, the assassination of MLK, and, you know, I mean, we could keep going. I'll tell you another anecdote by Angleton. In 1956, when Israel invaded Egypt, he told the director of the CIA the night before, he told him that Israel was not planning on invading Egypt, and he said that he'd been with Israelis the night before, and that they'd told him that they didn't have any such preparations in mind. And then, in short order after that, Israel invades Egypt, right? So invades the Sinai. So. You know, so Angleton's covering for them ever since the 1950s.
Yeah.
all throughout the 1960s into the 1970s. He helped shape that U.S.-Israeli policy more so than anybody. And he did it without any supervision, without any press, without any knowledge of the CIA or the administration. It was all back channels.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that makes a pretty clear case to me of, and again, who has the motive? What's the motivation, right?
Kind
of
thing.
LBJ, you have that interesting, the wink on the airplane, Air Force One, when he's being sworn in with.
Yeah, obviously LBJ, he becomes Albert president, Thompson, right? Yeah. He becomes president, so he gets to be the man.
Yeah.
Right? And I do think that he helped cover it up. I think that's pretty obvious. I think.
Yeah.
But did he have knowledge beforehand? I don't think that you can prove it, and I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a cog in a big machine, yes. Basically, and he fit right in, and it was like, yeah. That's our guy, we'd rather have him, we can't have any of this, you know, registering, you know, Jewish, you know, Zionist organizations under the Farah Act, and, you know, things like this. The remember that they built the fake stage, like a set in Dimona?
They built a fake nuclear reactor control room, with
yes.
Fake dials and everything,
yep.
To fool JFK's inspectors.
I can pull up a photo of that. I think I saw a couple of articles on that too. But yeah, there's so many of these things. And of course, now they are one of the few countries that are not haven't agreed to sign on to the non-nuclear proliferation treaty.
Yes, and that's actually why they qualify for United States financial aid.
What?
Because our laws say that we can't give foreign aid to countries who...
Who don't
sign the nuclear non-proliferation
gotcha.
Treaty. So the whole reason why Israel hasn't acknowledged its nuclear program, it's not. I mean, part of it is because they don't want people to know exactly what they have and what hand they're holding, just like in poker. But if they were to acknowledge their nuclear program, they haven't signed the non-proliferation treaty, and they would no longer qualify for aid from the United States.
Interesting. Yeah, here we go. How is it built? Is this the one? Maybe not. Anyway, people can search for it. There's a lot of stories out there in terms of like the
fake factories. And the other interesting thing is that they swore they needed the nuclear program to pay for desalination plants for drinking water. They didn't build any desalination plants until like the late 90s or early 2000s. So this nuclear energy they needed for the desalination plants, somehow they had drinking water for 30 or 40 years without it, without using their nuclear power.
Well, they're just genius. You know, they just make the desert bloom.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
all these other nations are just like, it's just in the sand. They're like, yeah, cut off the aid. Let's see what happens. Man, it's like $250 billion now since like 1946. And then they pay to Egypt is basically
it, but
a bribe.
But that was in, nominal, it's over $400 billion since 1951. But, you know, Dan Bilzerian did the original analysis, and I chipped in a little bit on the back end. But if you take all the money that we've given to Israel, Egypt, and Jordan since 1951, because we pay Egypt and Jordan to play nice with Israel.
Yeah.
If you take that money and you just let it accrue interest according to the average, you know, long-term treasury rate, the average annual long-term treasury rate, that money would have grown into almost $10 trillion in 2024. So we've only given them about $400 some billion. But if you kept that money and let it just grow risk-free at the, you know, with it, just give it interest like a savings account, basically, it would be $10 trillion now. $10 trillion.
Just a big hoax for the whole... the usury shit.
So what I tell people is like, you might say, well, Israel's our greatest ally and they do a lot for us. And I'm number one, nobody can ever name what they do for us.
Yeah.
But let's say they can name something. Is it worth 10 trillion?
No. Yeah. It's interesting. Well, they're kind of keeping tabs, you know. Actually, why don't we play that with Jeffrey Sachs? He's doing an interesting, he's stepping up his rhetoric a little bit. I like overall some of the things he's talked about, right? He's been kind of interesting on the Ukraine-Russia war. He's been interesting on the Israeli thing recently. He's, of course, Jewish himself, but it was one clip I saw, and he stepped up his rhetoric a little bit, and it was kind of interesting because usually he doesn't, you know, it's just American foreign policy,
right.
And these are Americans doing this.
American without, empire.
Yeah, the empire building and stuff without going into any of the actual, you know, he talks about the lobby, but it's like that's just a minor thing. These are neoconservatives. This is America's interest kind of thing, right? But he did step up the rhetoric recently, and he talked about Netanyahu a little bit. And, of course, that's his one kind of problem, too, that if you replace Netanyahu tomorrow, nothing's going to change. It might even get worse, obviously, but it's not. That's not what's doing it. This is a group, you know, religious yeah. ethnic interest that's pushing into this is their land. It was given to them. They're going to establish their, you know, kingdom. They're going to rule over all the other nations. And, you know, this is what they want. This is a religious thing. You can't replace a politician only and think that this is all going to, you know, work itself out. Anyway, here's the clip. Let me play this here. Kind of interesting. He says he's called Netanyahu the greatest disastrous president of the 21st century. And how he ran American policy, that foreign policy. Now, that's true, but so many other ones of them do, too.
Netanyahu has a different idea. His idea is we captured the Palestinian lands in 1967, and we're never going to give them back. So we're just going to rule over the Palestinians. He says we're going to keep the land. There will be resistance, Hamas, Hezbollah, other militant resistance. What will we do about it? You can't really fight the terrorists, he says. You have to fight the states that back the terrorists.
And Iran is the central one in his mind.
But interestingly for Netanyahu, he lays out one by one, yes, of course, Iran is the central one in his mind, but so too is Iraq under Saddam. He supported Hamas. Right. So too is Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya. And you know what the plan was? Seven wars in 5 years. The U.S. using Israel? No. This is Israel using the U.S. as if our military is right. is in their hands, which in effect it is. You take Wolfowitz and you take Feith and you take these neocons and you take Netanyahu. They right. game planned the whole thing out.
Who are they, Jeffrey?
Netanyahu as having been our greatest disastrous president of the 21st century because he ran American foreign policy for 20 years and he cost us trillions of dollars. And where is the Middle East today? War in Syria, war in Lebanon, war in Palestine, unrest in Iraq, war in Yemen, chaos in Sudan, chaos in Somalia, chaos in Libya. Great job, Bibi. You did a terrific job.
I think that's slightly better.
That's amazing that he's laid all that out. It's always hard to trust these people, but yeah. You know, Jeffrey Sachs has been allied, if you go way back, he's been allied with George Soros for a long time. And of course, George Soros, is a political opponent of Benjamin Netanyahu. So it's like, is he really telling the truth here for the benefit of the United States, or is he sort of taking a shot at his political rival, Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, I also think it's this disagreement internally of, like, Netanyahu is helping to ruin Israel's right. reputation internationally. Nations are turning – he's interrupting – well, from our point of view, he's interrupting the enemy as to make a mistake. That's kind of how I see it, right? So right. they were like, hey, slow down a little bit. They're, like, noticing a bit too much here. Again, he's not wrong. But he doesn't, of course, openly says that those neoconservative interests are primarily Jewish interests.
Yeah, as E. Michael Jones would say, the neokonskis.
Neokonskis, there you go, yeah. The neocoens, right? There's
yeah,
another one.
Neocoens.
This is obvious, but let's rehash this. You never know who's tuning in, and there's new people that haven't seen all these clips and whatnot, but here's Netanyahu. This is back in 1980 sometime, and I was talking about how basically, you know, we have America. It's our bitch. That's basically what it says. Listen here.
אנחנו הולכים למסלול התנגשות עם הממשל האמריקאי.
ארצות הברית זה לא מקשה אחת. זה לא מקשה אחת. יש את הסנאט, יש את הקונגרס, יש את הכוח היהודי שהוא עצום, יותר חזק משהיה אי פעם. יש דעת קהל, יש לנו כוחות כבירים בדעת הקהל שמתנגדים למדיניות הזאת, גדולי הפרשנים. אמריקה לא תכפה לנו דבר.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, they're running the show, and they know it. Yeah. They're running foreign policy. They know about all these things. They know what they can do. And again, let's see what happens over the next, what do you give it, a couple of years? Trump is in there now. He's probably going to do their bidding. And again, it's not that, like, Trump is going to start a war. It's about what happens around him.
He just gave a 2-month ultimatum to Iran to form a new deal, right?
That's right.
But he ripped up the last deal with Iran. So, like, and they just broke the ceasefire, you know, in Gaza. So it's like, why would Iran want to make another deal with the guy who ripped up the last deal they made with them?
I don't know. Do you think they want them to have nukes so they can, like, use that as an excuse?
You know, some people think that Iran does have nukes on the down low. Maybe they did secretly develop one with their nuclear program. Maybe Russia gave them some. You know, I don't know for certain. But, you know, obviously they want to topple Iran. They want to neuter Iran. They want to get rid of Iran's ability to resist Israel. Because, you know, Iran's been backstopping the Houthis. Hamas and Hezbollah and some of these other groups, right, trying to surround Israel, keep it hemmed in. Because, you know, to Jeffrey Sachs's point, you know, this 7 countries in 5 years thing, that's from over 20 years.
Oh, that's a long, yeah, they're behind schedule for sure.
And so Iran has been feeling this. They saw what happened to Saddam. They saw what happened to Gaddafi. They saw what happened to Assad. They saw what happened to all of these leaders, right? And these, all these countries that are now in perennial chaos and poor and defanged, and their people are suffering and starving and have terrible economies and internal fighting and why? Because it weakens them so that Israel can, you know, establish its hegemony and not be under threat. So obviously, you know, the Persian people is a proud people that have been around for thousands of years. You know, they have their own thriving civilization and country, and, you know, they don't want to, you know, they don't want to be toppled and overthrown and have their lives turn into chaos like all these other countries.
Yeah.
You know, you can understand it. And by the way, why isn't the United States, we used to have a friendly relationship with Iran. Why aren't we doing just nice, peaceful, open business with Iran like we used to?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's interesting. I think they have their guy lined up too, Reza Pahlavi, which is of the, you know, the old dynastic line in Iran. And was it, didn't they talk? Did they help topple his dad too? Did they not? No.
Well, so they toppled the previous government in 1954 to install the Shah.
That's right, the Shah they put in place.
I think that was Operation Ajax or something in like 1954. So the CIA. So it was like the CIA was already like doing Israel's bidding back in like the 50s. Blackmail and who knows what else. And then in 1979, of course, you had the revolution. And there's different opinions on that. My own opinion is because the Shah was sort of, he was starting to go off script. And so they tried to oust him, but it backfired on him. And the, you know, the, was it the Muslim Brotherhood or whoever?
Yeah,
you know,
they were.
They, decision, that right. wasn't supposed to go that direction, but it ended up going that direction. So they lost their control over the Shah and they lost their control over Iran. So Iran's off script for them now.
Yeah.
And so, but it still kind of worked because they've been able to paint them as terrorists and sort of blackball them from the rest of the Arab world. You know, for a long time, Iran didn't have diplomatic relations like with Saudi Arabia, you know, but that's all changed. That's all changed. Since October 7th, Iran and Saudi Arabia have reopened their diplomatic ties, which is bad. You know, that's not a good thing for Israel. So,
yeah, because this guy, he's visited many times to Israel. He praises them significantly all the time. Here's one piece. Well, this is one of his tweets, but here's one, right? Significant Reza Pahlavi's visit to Israel. He seems to be, you know, in their pockets, essentially, here.
It looks like it. I mean, there he is at the wall.
He's at the wall here in this one. And, of course, they're invoking Cyrus again. And, of course, Trump got that the commemorative coin with Cyrus on it.
Right.
Which was the great king of Persia that gave the Jews what they wanted, right?
So if people don't know Cyrus, so when in about 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon basically conquered Jerusalem, sacked Jerusalem, and carried a bunch of Jews back to Babylon. Later, about, I want to say in the 520s or 530s, somewhere around there, Cyrus the Great of Persia, he overthrows Babylon and frees the Jews. And some of them go back to Israel. A lot of them stay where they pick up their Babylonian money magic, and you hear, you know, and that's why you have a Babylonian Talmud, right? Because the large Jewish population that remained in Babylon.
Yeah.
But Cyrus was seen as the great, you know, the great, you know, freer of the captives of the Jewish captives of Babylon.
That's right. Was it the wife? It's the wife of someone that? No, that was a Roman period. That's much later. Never mind that. The son of the last Shah of Iran arrived in Israel as guest of the Minister of Intelligence. And he, like, kind of repeated a lot of these, like, oh, they make the desert bloom, and, oh, they have fresh water, they're so great, we should mimic it here. So it looks like, I mean, maybe ideally, I'm not sure, because much of this is like, yeah, they wanted genocide people too, by the way. There's like, you know, exterminate the Amalek and go after Esau and Edom and all this stuff, right? They have that in there, but... So maybe they want to kill Iran, you know, I don't know, but I'm saying...
I think they just want to defang it and neuter it.
They
want to get rid of its nuclear program, and they want to bring it to heel.
Yeah.
And if they can install their guy through, like, maybe a color revolution or through some other subterfuge, then they'll do that.
That'd be the easiest way, I would assume, for them. So, yeah, I mean, they did try to... There was some protest there for a while, remember? They wanted to restore the Iranian dynasty, and, you know, there was a faction within Iran.
Yeah, so this Reza, he's the son of the Shah, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, anyway, that's something to keep an eye on. I wanted to cover some of that for a while and never really got to it. This is a good place to do it, just mentioning that to make people aware of that, like, yeah, this guy...
Ministry of Intelligence.
Yep, wow. Yep.
There it is right there. Yep.
So yeah. Anyway, they want him in there. So we'll see what happens on that. Now, going on from there, I guess we can cover, I wanted to play a clip out of Australia because it is related to kind of, what happens at the campuses here in the U.S. There's a lot you can say about that and these, deportations. We didn't get any mass deportations of illegals, even it looks like.
But it looks like they're going to try and mass deport Gazans. So Israel gets to have mass deportations, but sorry, America, you fell for it again.
It's just too expensive. We can't use any of that Doge money that we've saved to actually hire more agents or whatever. I bet you people would line up for freedom, what do they call them? Mercenary contracts or whatever. Apparently, they are legally bound, right? Like you can't actually go into a residence. You can knock on the door if they answer. Look, they've been schooled, obviously. There's people within the FBI. They were leaking information to local radio stations in San Francisco, telling them basically stay inside, telling them a raid is about to happen and stuff like that. So they certainly undermined those efforts of actually trying to take care of the illegal migrant problem here. So I'm not saying that, but very low. They stopped reporting the numbers on the ICE website and, things like this, right? But in Australia, they have a similar clampdown. It was over this fake, I'm not sure if you follow that at all, if you follow international politics in that way, but they had this fake caravan, they call it. I'm not sure why they call it a caravan, but anyway, bombings against synagogues, and there was graffiti and stuff. And then later on, it came out a lot of this has basically just been, made up. In fact, I have a clip where the police talks about this. Let me pull that in real quick. Caravan anti-Semitism, fake hoax. Hoax crime in Australia in order to basically spur on these new hate speech laws. Here's a short clip with the two different stories.
Clearly, police are very concerned and the community is very concerned about the rising number of anti-Semitic attacks in our community escalating to the point where there was a mass casualty event.
Today, I can reveal that the caravan was never going to cause a mass casualty event, but instead was concocted by criminals who wanted to cause fear for personal benefit.
And then the follow-up on that is that a third party was paid to basically do these attacks, and that remains unspoken so far. What's going on with that? And it's all right, here we go again. And it's almost like the swastika is this kind of powerful talisman, because I don't think they are actually bad at drawing it. They intentionally don't actually want to draw it the way it is.
They don't cross it because they can't. In Israel and Jews in general, they don't use a plus sign for addition. They use a little upside down T because the plus sign is a cross.
Yeah.
So they don't draw it. And so a lot of these fake swastikas, and I've seen them before on some of these proven hoaxes, they're not drawn like you and I would draw them, where you just sort of cross the two different axes.
Yeah.
It'll be like this weird sort of I can't even describe.
Squiggly, angular. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't cross the lines. They'll put two halves together, but not cross them. And it's because that's how much they hate Jesus.
I think that's where the kaikel comes from too, right? The circle, old Greek, is it?
Kaikel is Hebrew for circle.
Yeah.
And when they came into the United States, when they were immigrating, they wouldn't sign their name with an X because it was a cross. So they drew a circle.
Is that because I've heard the claim that they were illiterate and so they couldn't write their name?
A lot of these masses were allegedly illiterate, and so they would have them sign an X. These immigrants came in, they'd sign an X for their signature, but they didn't want to make an X because that's a cross, so they'd make a circle. And the Hebrew word for circle is kaikel.
Yeah, so that's where that comes from.
Yeah,
they made the slur. All right, so anyway, so here's an update on this, where basically now then in Australia again it's much mimicking right in the U.S. in that sense that we have to test you. Germany has even talked about this too, remember, there could be mass rage, just total chaos on the streets in Germany. And then all of a sudden, there's some pro-Palestinian protest. Holy shit, the police comes out and clamps down. Now there's going to be citizen tests here that's going to include anti-Semitism. Basically, they need to test for that. Not anti-Australianism or anti-whiteism or something like that. No, it's specifically designed for them. And I think the population is very low of Jews in Australia too, by the way. But these are the trends now. And here, in fact, latest update is the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, talking about how basically free speech is incompatible with this multiculturalism that they're trying to build here. Listen to this.
I recognize, and I've fully said from the beginning, that we don't have the same freedom of speech laws that they have in the United States. And the reason for that is that we want to hold together our multicultural community and have people live in peace
free from the kind of vilification and hatred that we do see around the world.
I think that's true, though. Like, you can't actually... The only way a multiracial, multi-ethnic society can work is basically by having authoritarianism, right? You can't criticize each other. You can't say anything bad about each other. That seems to be the path that they're choosing.
Well, right? You look at Syria that was held together for the last several years by Assad. You had these different factions. You had the Druze, you had the Christians, you had the Muslims, you had different factions of the Muslims. And he was holding it all together. They've deposed him, and you see all the massacres happening now and all the chaos that's happening. And, you see these in other sectarian countries where you have these different factions and a strong man holds it all together, and then you get rid of the strong man, and now all of a sudden things just fall apart. Multicultural societies are inherently, it sounds tautological, but they're not homogeneous.
Right.
But they're not naturally unified. They're naturally at odds.
Yes.
Right? They're naturally chaotic states, different religions, different races, different languages, different cultures. Where's the unity? Where's the unification? So there's natural chaos. There's natural lines of pressure and chaos. And so, you have to only some kind of an authoritarianism is able to sort of contain that chaos. Right. And so, I think in one sense, a multicultural society is incompatible with something like free speech.
Yeah, any kind of liberty
right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, remember this when they, speaking of Syria, and it's not that they backed the wrong guy. This is not a mistake. This is by design. Same thing here. We go back to, how proud Netanyahu said that historic moment, we helped to topple Assad, that he's been an enemy for a long time, whatever. But remember this one, like... Oh, the jihadists are coming in. They're totally diversity friendly. And then, what, 2 months later, we see, people crawling on the street like dogs and being executed.
Yeah,
and, I mean, horrific
scenes,
basically.
It's terrible what's happening there.
Absolutely. But this is what they do, right? Chaos. They thrive on chaos and murder. And this is a standard MO. This is how they get their goals. And it's almost like we're... And it's not about you stooping to their level, obviously, but we're always playing too nice, in a way. This is what happens. We're caught off guard. We don't think the same. We don't have the same moral framework. They're ruthless, right? And part of that, sure, it could be, look, again, going back to the JFK stuff and the assassinations there and the bombings early on, they have, the outrage porn of the Holocaust also at the forefront, right?
This about 80 years ago, Henrik, that matters to me about as much as McKinley or Garfield.
That's true, exactly. Yeah, well, who cares about that? It's irrelevant to this day and age. Yeah, that's now we know the comeback, I guess.
Right,
with facts and logic. They have that there, fresh in their memory. So they're like, at any means necessary, we need to accomplish what we need to accomplish, and we need our state, and blah, blah, blah. So it stands to reason that they would employ any kind of tactic, including... As we said, assassinations, lying, cheating, stealing, you're doing everything you can. But then on top of that, you do have, which we didn't really get into, but obviously the blackmail issue,
right?
The Epstein issue, all of these issues where they deploy a completely different tactic. It's still threats, it's still illegal, but that's the reason why we can't turn anything around in our countries. Because at the top of the leadership, we have people that are compromised, they're a slave to their vices,
right.
They're filmed in compromising situations, or they are baited into it, or who knows what's on there.
Whatever it is that they, are they attracted to little boys and girls? Are they attracted to riches? Are they attracted to, do they have other blackmail material on them? Drugs, crimes, what is it? I'm sure it's different from person to person. To some degree, but I call it the dark arts. They're willing to employ all the dark arts: blackmail, murder, extortion, racketeering, all of these things without compunction, no problem, right? You and I, we have a sensibility and morality where, there's lines we won't cross. These people will cross any line. They're willing to blow the head off of a U.S. president right in broad daylight on TV.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, in fact, it might be, as I said, effectful to show to the next guy coming
Absolutely.
In that you better bow down here. Another thing we could talk about, I'm not sure, this is more for fun, I guess, to a certain extent, but did you hear about the return of the Statue of Liberty?
I did hear about that.
It was kind of funny. But here was a clip. There was Louis C.K.
Maybe you can take the poem at the, M. Lazarus poem.
That's
take
what
that.
I said.
You can have the poem.
Take that to Israel.
Take that poem to Israel.
Take that back to Israel. And but anyway, this is, he said here, she destroyed the reporter here with this comeback about the Statue of Liberty because some French politician asked for it back. Whatever, but let's listen to this here.
There is now a member of the European Parliament from France who does not think the U.S. represents the values of the Statue of Liberty anymore. They want the Statue of Liberty back. So is President Trump going to send the Statue of Liberty back to France?
Absolutely not. And my advice to that unnamed low-level French politician would be to remind them that it's only because of the United States of America that the French are not speaking German right now. So they should be very grateful to our great country.
Yeah, thank there God. Really, no really dodged a bullet on really, that one.
You know, I ran a poll last week. You know, would the French rather be France now or Vichy France?
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Vichy France won.
Well, of course. Of course.
And was Vichy France speaking French or German, by the way?
They were speaking French.
They
would have continued to speak French. Yeah. That's the thing. But it's funny because someone pointed out, too, well, while she's speaking a Germanic language.
Right, yeah.
But it's like, you know, yeah, okay, you don't have to get into the weeds here, right?
Right,
The Sister Revolution and the Nine Sisters Lodge and Benjamin Franklin and all that stuff, right? They were intricately involved at the time of the American Revolution, the French, right? This is part of the reason.
Yeah, I mean, we do owe the French. You know? We would not have beat the British without the help of the French. It's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we've repaid that debt many, many times over.
You have the issue, of course, also of the fact that, now they're going to be speaking Arabic primarily in France in 20 years or so. Or,
right?
You know, like, that's the other thing to this, of course. But it's like it still is.
I would like to know if that French politician's even French.
Yeah, exactly. That can very well be true, right? But yeah, you can kind of complain on it. It was certainly, I mean, the founders, they were, if not like out and right call themselves white nationalists, the policies that they advocated certainly was as close as you can get to that without, you know, saying
America's the original white nationalist country. And let me explain what I mean by that, Henrik, because people don't understand the idea of white, right, that we now know it as, was really developed by white American Christians, right? That was really developed by us. And they put it, our first Congress in 1790, of course, everybody knows, put, you know, who could be a citizen of the United States? A free white person of good character who's been a resident of the United States for 2 years, right? And so there's your original white nationalist country. And there were many laws passed over the years, several acts of Congress throughout the 1790s and into the 1800s. And then you had the Chinese Exclusion Acts in the 1800s. And then you had the Immigration Act in 1921, 1924, 1954. All of these laws specifically, basically, were designed to keep America a white Christian country. And in 1965, America was 93% Christian and 89.5% white. And that was actually whiter than it was in 1790. You know, so it was actually whiter in 1965 than it ever had been before.
Right.
And so America was an explicit white nationalist country. And what's interesting is we're told white nationalism is evil, and we can't have it because white nationalism leads to Hitler, the Nazis, and that leads to the Holocaust of the Jews. And so every nation and race on earth and culture on earth can have nationalism. Blacks can have nationalism, Chinese, Japanese, they can all have nationalism. The Jews in Israel, they can have nationalism. Everybody can have nationalism, but not white people. Because when white people do nationalism, you get Hitler and you get the Holocaust. That's what they tell us. They don't tell you that actually America was white nationalist for almost 200 years before that, and for 20 years after that, and our white nationalists beat the German white nationalists and saved the Jews from the rest of the Holocaust. So if you're asking me, Henrik, white nationalism is actually a reason, that's actually an argument for having it. You know, we stopped the Holocaust, right? We stopped the Holocaust. America should get white nationalism because we saved everybody.
Yeah.
They don't talk about that. They don't tell you about that. They tell you these lies that we're always a multicultural country and a multiracial country and all this, you know, this garbage, but that's just not true.
No, again, it's the plaque inside, Emma Lazarus, Jewish activism, Israel Zangwill, the melting pot, and it's just, you know, it's rolled on since then. But of course, this is, you know, advantageous to them because now they can be one minority among many, and of course, instead of having all the eyes on them as being an outsider, now it's much easier for them to actually hide, and many of them have, you know, explicitly said so, in fact, that this is like a goal. Then, of course, I think there's the aspect, too, of I think they hate us more than they love their own. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And I mean, there's plenty of clips out there with rabbis talking about this and like Amalek, of course. And, you know, it's kind of sometimes they apply to Palestinian, but sometimes it's the Germans and sometimes it's just Europe or the West overall. You know, you have Edom, Esau as well. But I think that's one of the, you know, this is one of their commandments that like you need to eradicate these people. And the rabbis talk about like they need to intermarry with what do they call it? Shem is them, right? Edom is us. What's the Muslims again?
Ham?
Is that Ham? I thought that was the blacks.
Or maybe I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I think there's one of the sons to Abraham, right?
Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
Maybe Japheth. I forget who it is. But anyway, they've said that, whatever the word they use for the Arabs, they're like, they need to interbreed with the whites, the Edomites, essentially, right? And that's the way, that's our plan to get rid of them, essentially.
Right.
But of course, another way they're doing that is through war. What do you think about this America backing off, openly criticizing Zelensky? Now the EU have kind of stepped up here, essentially, which is funny because the EU leaders, and the EU is very different than Europe, obviously. EU is a bureaucratic legal institution, essentially, that's now holding the rest of Europe hostage, essentially. But they got so angry with Trump over this that they decide to do exactly what he wants, which is to arm up and pay for this themselves.
Yeah.
I think it's disastrous.
It could draw us back in because we still have assets over there. And if they escalate the conflict and our assets, get attacked and killed or whatever, isn't that just going to pull us back in?
I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, I think it looks like they're ramping up. Unless there's some genuine peace negotiations here that actually lead somewhere, we'll see what happens. Yeah. The ball's been kind of going back and forth between, America, Putin, and Zelensky, obviously, back and forth here. But it just, when they start showing just like all white military army ads and like in Britain and in Germany.
The
U.S. too has done it. Yeah, exactly. You kind of feel that the war drums are beating here. You know what I mean? I'm like,
absolutely.
I'm really worried about where this is going. It would be disastrous to get us dragged into war.
I mean, Germany is already gutted. They're deindustrializing.
Yeah.
After the Nord Stream attack. They can't pay for energy. They can't get energy, and so that's crippling their industry.
Yeah.
That's you can't have industry without energy. Right. And so they don't have energy. So it's crippling their industry. And, and Germany's going to get they're going to go to war now again.
Yeah.
All out war.
In their weakest possible position, essentially. Yeah. Right. They have no, even the old car industry that they could use to as you said, a revamp to a military style production, system or whatever you want to call it.
But how many depleted. Times in 100 years is Europe going to be fooled into going to war for these people?
Yeah, well, that's just it. And that's what I wanted to get to with this, the Statue of Liberty and then this kind of beef, between America and Europe, right? It's like, obviously, the people that are also occupying America and driving its foreign interests are the ones that are, want Europe to go in this direction.
That's right.
That's what I feel. And so...
And they roped us into World War One. They started a war in Europe in World War One. They roped us in. Then they started that war in Europe again in World War Two and roped us in again. And it looks like they're trying to do it again.
Yeah.
Take Europe to war and rope us in again.
Yeah. Obviously, Europe should have a strong defense structure. I'm not against that, obviously, but I'm saying it's for all the wrong reasons now that this is being pushed.
It's not in their interest. This war is not in their interest.
No,
it's in somebody else's interest.
That's just it. And with all the meddling of these former satellite states to the Soviet Union, right? Like coup after coup and Orange Revolution and these neocons and these Jewish activists from the Newlands to the Kagans. It's just decades long. And then people are like kind of pretending that this just showed out of nowhere for no reason whatsoever, all of a sudden. And now this is a huge problem. We gotta arm up now, kind of thing. So I think these EU leaders are, despite the fact that outwardly, they feel, betrayed or shocked or all those things. If that separation can occur, that's ultimately great. Like get the American foreign interests, which again are also suppressing the interests of Americans, European Americans, get them off the backs of Europe and European nations, so we actually can rise up. Because you have all that thing, right? From the Marshall Plan, the German Marshall Fund initially, to NATO, obviously, in and of itself, to, USAID, you could tie into this, of like the different, like running, gay tranny ballets in Serbia, and all this, ultimately, that's good, right, in terms of Doge exposing that and what the administration is doing. I just feel that it's like this underhanded hook attached to this, that at some point here, it's going to become known to us of why this is being done. What's your sense of this?
Well, I mean, you look at who's really who's under the control of Europe, and you look at the alliance that Netanyahu formed with NATO last year. A lot of people don't know about this, but the new head of NATO, Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, he's the former prime minister of the Netherlands, and he basically cut a deal with Netanyahu last year, and he denied war crimes in Gaza. I think he distributed a memo. He denied war crimes in Gaza, and that got Netanyahu and Israel to throw their support behind him, and he became the new Secretary General of NATO. And in July of last year, NATO open an office, I believe, in Jordan. Why is NATO opening an office in Jordan in July 2024?
Well, why is, you know, Turkey a member?
Yeah. I mean, and why is Turkey a member? Like, and NATO nations were flying support missions, have been flying support missions in August and October when Iran counterattacked Israel after Israel attacked Iran, and Iran counterattacked in August and October, especially in October. NATO was flying support missions for Israel's response back then. So there's an alliance that's formed between NATO and Israel. And people don't understand that. And, you know, if you look at Zelensky and who he is and who's behind him, he's a Jew, right? Okay. And Victoria Nuland and Antony Blinken, who were prosecuting this Ukrainian war, right? This NATO-Ukraine war. Neocons, Jews,
yeah.
Right? The neocons.
Yeah.
They've got this generational hatred against Russia. And Keir Starmer's wife, Jewish. Geert Wilders' wife, Jewish. I think he's part Jewish as well.
Yeah,
Maloney, she's a Zionist. She's bought off by them. You got Viktor Orban in Hungary. He's also Zionist. On down the list, right? So, Marine Le Pen, I think she, in the last French elections, she wanted to back off, like, support for the Ukraine war. Well, so then they formed a coalition between the center right and the left to defeat her.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what's his name? I forget his name. He was like a Croatian or Serbian.
Vucic?
One that they tried to assassinate last year, like in November 2023. He was saying we should get out of Ukraine. And then they, this is about greater Israel and, world Jewish hegemony. Frankly, I think that's what this is.
I think you're right. So yeah, you have this weird,
because Israel, if it can control the world island, the confluence of three continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa, it's right there. If it can control the oil and the gas and the grain and the resources flowing through that region, mm-hmm. and it establishes the greater Israel hegemon, that's the control of the world island. They become the superpower, global superpower of the 21st century.
All the trade will go through there.
All the trade will go through there. But you got to take care of Russia. You got to take care of Russia.
What do you think about the Chabad connection on the back end of that? And
it's there as well. You know what I learned a couple weeks ago? Chabad was operating a spy ring in the Soviet Union.
In the day. They're well established there. They have been, right,
for a long time. And I don't think that went anywhere. So, and where did Javier Milei, the Jewish president of Argentina, go? Where was his first trip?
Israel.
It was to the World Chabad headquarters in New York, actually.
Oh, was that what it was?
Yeah.
His first foreign... Oh, okay. That would be his first foreign.
And then where did Trump go?
Yeah.
He went to the same place. He went to Chabad, the Rebbe Schneerson.
The grave with Ben Shapiro, by the way.
With Ben Shapiro.
Yeah.
And this is the worldwide headquarters of the Chabad movement, right? So... there is that link, that connection that is happening. And so you can't understand these undercurrents, in my opinion, unless you understand world Jewry, organized international Jewry, and their goals and what they're doing. And it does get murky. It gets a little complicated, but I do believe that these things are connected. And I think a lot of what's going on, I think they're killing many birds with the same shekel here. It's a white Christian meat grinder. They're clearing out part of Ukraine to establish this this Heavenly Jerusalem project. You can go look up the Heavenly Jerusalem project, another homeland for Jews. And they have a generational hatred against Russia. They also want to defang Russia, just like they want to defang Iran, right? And you can go look up 200 Years Together by Alexander Solzhenitsyn to understand that. And, so I think that's all, it's all connected.
Yeah, indeed. There was a point there you brought up. I think there's a beef against Ukraine as well, right? That's the reason why they're using Ukraine, right? There's the old pogroms there and they complain.
Right.
I mean, it used to be the Chabad Center, actually.
Right.
That's what, that's where the Rebbe was initially, wasn't it? Oh, he was still there until he died, I think, in Ukraine, wasn't it?
Yeah, many of them come from there, right?
Yeah.
Many of them come from there. So, let's get revenge on the white Christians that are left there. And let's also use them to get revenge on Russia, and let's make another homeland for Jews, and let's also if you want full control of the world island, you gotta defang Russia, right? Because Russia still controls some of those shipping lanes and those routes and some of those resources, and so you want to bring Russia to heel. Right.
Yeah, it seems to be enough of a problem there that they want to. They do a lot of cringe things themselves too, obviously, where they're like I'll say this, and I bring this up every time it comes up, but it's like this: they keep like blaming, you know, like Anglo-Saxons and stuff like that. There's no way they don't know who's involved. I mean, I'm not saying they never have mentioned like neoconservatives or whatever, but like if they really, they still call Ukrainians Nazis and it's all the Nazis in Kiev.
Because the
blah,
Nazis
blah,
are
blah.
Evil.
So like this, oh my gosh. Like it's one of the greatest intelligence failures of the 21st century. For the FSB to not recognize who's actually involved in pulling the strings, meddling, doing coups, and or you know color revolutions in many of these former Soviet states, and they just won't say that. They just won't piece that together and present that image to the world. And I still don't know why. I mean,
is Putin a boomer? I've heard people say, well, you know, Putin's a boomer too, and he's still thinking like a boomer in some respects. I don't know that I buy that, but you know, he's also a former intelligence operative, so you always have to layer that in. And also he's trying to, you know, not, you know, let the world gang up against him in World War III. So he's diplomatic. You know, the oligarchs of Russia are all Jewish. He's got to appease them. So he's, you know, he's dancing a tightrope too.
He did kick some of them out, obviously, right? This is one of the reasons why Boris Berezovsky became so involved, actually, in funding the Orange Revolution in Ukraine at the time. He was using one of his media guys there, Alexander Goldfarb. This is back in like 2004, 2003, mm-hmm. something like this. And so I get that he kicked out what he put for a while. Was it Abramovich, I think, in jail or something like that? I mean, there was a couple of them, right?
He seems to have sort of brought them to heel, or they've come to some sort of detente.
But there's enough of them left. Yeah. A few of them did leave. And I mean, Boris Berezovsky was, I think, assassinated. He was found hung in his... I mean, he was like jet-setting between Tel Aviv and London, basically.
Right.
But these are the forces there that were playing that. But now it seems to be this, like, at least internally in Russia, they have that... That's an issue still there. That hasn't been resolved.
Well, you know, there's organized international Jewry. And they do have factions. And roughly speaking, you have the neocons, okay? These are Jews who focus on Russia as the main problem. Then you have what I call Zionicons, okay? Zionist conservatives. And they focus on Iran now, the greater Middle East, but now it's Iran, as the problem, as the main problem. And then you have a new entrant, the Silicons. I call them the Silicons, the Silicon Valley tech bros. And they see China, or they focus on China as the new evil or the new problem.
Yeah.
But you know, you look at the silicon tech bros, the silicons. You got the neocons, the zeocons, and the silicons, and Russia, Iran, China, right? And so they all sort of have a different focus, but when you put them together, you know, it's still organized. It's this organized international Jewry against these pocket holdouts against their world domination.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very interesting because, you know, Doge, artificial intelligence, obviously they're running this. It's impossible for humans to go through much of this in the speed that they have done. So I've talked about this in the past where basically now they're doing a test case. Can AI run government? What becomes interesting is eventually, of course, when it gets executive power, basically, right. And it becomes a legal entity. Well, now it's better than any human. Because, it's objective, you see, kind of thing.
And you've got to think about the digital control grid that they're talking about establishing, Project Stargate. And Larry Ellison's talking about how we're going to have this total, complete surveillance society where they're going to know every transaction you make, everywhere you go. They're going to know every purchase you make, every transaction you make, all your travels, all the relationships you have, maybe even some sort of, you know, knowing what you're thinking. You know, with Neuralink and some of these other technologies, they're going to know what you're thinking even. And it's going to be impossible to escape this digital control grid, especially if the money's digital too.
Yeah.
If everything's digital and everything's on the smart grid and they can monitor everything and they have this super uber powerful artificial intelligence that can control and monitor everything, where's that going to leave our freedom and our liberty and our self-determination and sovereignty?
Well, as you said, then it's always someone has always have the programming ability, the back doors, the keys to, you know, because look at most AIs, they still glean from the same sources. It's still basically just a shit living disguise.
Right,
that's what it is, essentially.
And that's what it is now. Right, for now.
Exactly. It could be anything tomorrow, depending on what they want it to be. But it will be sold to us as this objective, better than us, better than you, right? Like it can do objective decision making. I wouldn't be surprised if you see these things initially being part of court proceedings, for example, eventually get, actually, as I said, executive legal decision making ability, essentially. We're so close at this now, and you have this whole guard that realize we can't. The momentum in terms of like national, and not that it's much of that, but like, you know, under Trump, that's where the momentum is. The Democrats are kind of like, let's hitch our wagons to this. Or if you can't beat it, join it, right? And take it over. And that's what I'm seeing they've done
with the PayPal mafia. That seems to be Elon, who's one of the heads of the PayPal mafia. That seems to be his mantra. We have to beat the tyrannical AI with a less tyrannical AI.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Let me do it. I'll build the demon, right? Remember those clips we talked about? We're building some new kind of alien, essentially.
But you know, it's a bait and switch. I mean, you look at the internet and social media. They sold it as this awesome, amazing, Wild West, ultimate freedom thing, and then they locked down the internet. And then they had these amazing, you know, social media platforms, Facebook, YouTube, Google, you know, Reddit, all these things. And they got everybody using these technologies and adopting these platforms. And then what happened? Then came the censorship.
Yeah.
Then came the control. Then came the debanking and the deplatforming and the cancellation. Well, what are they going to do when we're all riding around in their self-driving cars? What are they going to do when we all have to get our groceries through Amazon.com? You know, or whatever it is, or where we're dependent on this AI-powered digital control grid. You know, what are they going to do? It's going to be something really awesome and fantastic until everybody's on it and dependent upon it. And oh, here comes the censorship. Oh, you said something in one of our self-driving cars that's against Israel. Oh, well, you don't get to ride in our cars anymore.
Yeah,
oh, but you know, and it's a private,
they won't go anywhere.
And it's a private car, and so you don't have any right to use the car of a private company. It's a private company. It can do it at once.
Yeah.
So now you're not going to be able to travel anywhere. You're not going to be able to make money. You're not going to be able to buy groceries. You're not going to be able to eat unless you think and say and do exactly what they want you
to. Right. And that's the whole UBI issue on top of that, right? That these things. And
here's some money.
Here's some latest on the Boston Dynamics, some footage here, right, of how just incredibly, I mean, we're so close now to them basically beginning to replace humans with these things. The Tesla bots that they're building first, people laughed at it. Well, now a few years, 2 years later, almost three.
Wow.
They're very proficient. They're beginning to replace some human labor in the factories, in the Tesla factories. And all that data, by the way, that they've collected in their cars, all the artificial intelligence of what it has learned in terms of studying its environment, its behaviors, humans walking, how this, that, maybe what they talk about in the car, who knows, is going to be used to feed they're going to all be connected to the cloud, right? Essentially, and they will all get the update at the same time. I'm terrified about where this is going and who has the backdoor keys, because again, look, and it's not, I mean, sure, it could be a Chinese company doing it or whatever, right? But if Musk gets his way, they'll start wheeling out these things in the millions eventually, right? They're ramping up production of them right now. They're getting very, very well. They've studied this. They've used all the data that they've gathered from a word, I think it was actually one of the kind of adjacent to the PayPal mafia, Mark Andreessen mentioned this too, where he said that basically you have to think of the Tesla car as one of these robots on wheels.
That's exactly it. It's the same AI. It's the same AI technology.
Yep, absolutely.
Instead of legs, it's got wheels.
That's it. Yeah. And so now they're getting wheels, and now they're going to wheel them out. and we'll see what happens.
And they're going to put them in drones. They are putting it in drones.
Why not? It'll be everywhere.
And you know what? And they're already testing it in Gaza. In Gaza, these technologies and these AI systems that they've developed in Silicon Valley, they are helping, like Peter Thiel and Palantir, their AI systems are powering drones and targeting systems and software in Israel to kill Gazans.
Yes. And there was one of the critiques against Alex Karp at Palantir, remember? Oh, Lilac or what was some name?
Lavender.
Lavender. That they were using. And I was like, oh, this is no good. This is the, you know, kind of thing. But you've heard his comments. He's like a genocidal maniac. We should drone bomb our enemies. He's making jokes.
But that's going to come here. Like, you know, course, Google and Facebook helped construct China's social credit system. And I'm sure other Silicon Valley companies helped as well. You think they really don't want to – you think they helped develop that technology? They don't want to deploy it here? They're already deploying
they
it
are,
here,
of course. You know? Exactly.
And you look at Elon Musk. You know, what's Elon going to do when we're all using his internet and we're all using his cars and we're all using his robots and we're all using his X platform for banking and speech? Well, you know, he already de-verified me on Twitter. He already took my monetization on Twitter. He took away my paid subscribers. Why? Well, I don't know for sure because he didn't tell me, but I'm pretty sure it's because I opposed Israel and because I opposed his desire for more H-1B visas.
It's right. Yeah. That's right. It was a spat.
And so
that.
Me
right.
and yep. several, a few, a couple dozen other people, we were de-verified. We were demonetized. We had our subscriptions taken away. And several of them, like Project Groip, were outright banned. Yeah. All right. So that's, they've shown their hand. This is what they will do. Okay, you disagree with us. There goes your UBI. There goes your usage of the self-driving car. There goes your robot. There goes your banking. You know?
Yeah, programmable money. Now, I did pass some executive order against CBDCs, but this is about the private-public partnership thing that you kind of brought up earlier, right? We basically outsource portions of the government and turn it into a private endeavor. And they'll say, well, we'll save money doing this, you see. This will be good for the economy, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, so you have private crypto exchanges. But what happens when the private crypto exchanges enforce censorship?
Yeah, that's
now you can't use the
private.
They already
now,
do it.
We've been banned from multiple
right,
crypto
so you already can't do it. So here's the problem. And this so it's private. Private companies can do what they want.
Yes. And there you go. There you have it, right? And so, of course, who are these people? We've mentioned a few of them. You brought up David Sacks. He became the AI crypto czar, right? And he's, of course, again, ex PayPal mafia. He was initially very critical of Trump, and then all of a sudden he had that, All In podcast or something.
Right.
They were talking shit about Trump, blah, blah, blah. Then all of a sudden, just boom, turned their code immediately. It's like, he got the memo, basically.
Yeah, after October 7th, many of these guys got on board with Trump.
Yeah.
And then after the assassination attempt in Butler in July, then Trump had the people, got the people behind him. He got the motion behind him. Then the rest of them jumped on board. But you have people like Jacob Hellberg, Mark Andreessen, of course, Peter Thiel, David Sacks, the Winklevoss twins, Palmer Luckey, Sean McGuire. Sean McGuire's a Jew, by the way. He's at Sequoia Capital.
Mm-hmm.
that's an interesting rabbit hole. But a lot of the Silicon Tech Valley bros, a lot of them are Jews or Zionists or married to Jews and Zionists or doing business with Israel and their weapons and defense contractors. I mean, these, like Elon has to be thought of as a defense contractor. He's launching American military satellites into space. He's controlling internet. He's got defense contracts. So he's a weapons contractor. That's what he's a war contractor. That's who these people are.
Absolutely. So they're doing the and I brought up this example, but it proves, right, that they are running AI. This is not a secret, but people are still not kind of, it's not widely discussed, right? But they did basically control F's on some of those words. We're going to eradicate woke.
Right.
So gay showed up in the National Archives for the plane that dropped the first atomic bomb and Nola Gay. And so that was, it was a mistake. We removed that from the National Archives, essentially.
Wow.
Because it was gay. So it proves to you that it has executive power already.
Right.
It just runs through it, and then I'll delete these things or remove this or whatever. And I always felt that way.
Talk about the perfect memory hole. From 1984.
Exactly.
Now everything's digitized. With a punch of a button, literally, we can erase things.
Yes.
Or replace them. Yep. Or alter them.
Well, this is the Amazon Kindle, right, was the first idea of this. And, of course, kindling a fire, book burning.
Right,
Kindle.
Yeah.
But that you have to digitize everything, and then you can share. Or even that your device running AI on it, like a client AI on the operating system.
How many web pages can you no longer find? You go to Wikipedia, and they have, hey, here's the source for this claim. And you go to it, gone.
Yeah.
404, error.
So you have the dead internet theory and then the disappearing internet theory, too, right? People did the Google thing. You go down in the search results.
The first 20 pages and that, and then it just repeats.
It's just, where is all this?
Yeah.
Wonderful. I remember early days of the internet. It was fantastic. It was great. You can access all this information you wouldn't get anywhere else. And where are all these GeoCities websites and, blog spots and stuff? You know what I mean? Yeah. Much of that has been removed and gone. But I'm talking about them changing it in real time on your device, even. Even if you're reading something, do something, or you're accessing this, it can change it on a client level, essentially.
They could. Yeah, with the AI and the algorithms, they would have the technology eventually, to every person could get news and information tailored to you and your predilections and your point of view.
Yeah.
And it could keep track of that and have different stories it's telling everybody. And nobody would know that everybody's reading different information.
That's right. Exactly. And they do kind of, and that it goes back to what I mentioned earlier. Earlier that with Twitter, right? That they do. I bet you they run tests. So, you see what I'm saying?
Of course they do.
Let's check out what happened. We isolate this group into this little algorithmic bubble, essentially, and see how
Facebook
that, and
does
study
it. They
it,
all
and,
do
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
YouTube, Facebook, Google, everybody does it.
Yeah.
Of course they're doing it.
So even the Tony Blair Institute.
And we know that they would do this because we already know that their print, newspapers in different cities will have different headlines for the same story.
Sure.
We've already seen that kind of people hey, here's the Wall Street Journal from Chicago. Here's the Wall Street Journal for the same day from Texas. And it's got different headlines. And so we already know that they do this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Tailor-made news just for you. And eventually even an AI in of itself. I mean, imagine the manipulation. I mean, we're at the right at the cusp of this thing totally putting us in a digital prison, essentially, where we don't even know what's
real. Everybody knows real about anymore. Operation, well, not everybody, but a lot of people in this space know about Operation Mockingbird, where the CIA basically bought and infiltrated media, radio, television, magazines, newspapers, and they paid off reporters and journalists and newsmen, right, to basically parrot CIA, whatever the CIA talking points were, Operation Mockingbird. Well, they can accomplish much of the same thing now without having to pay anybody, simply through algorithmic manipulation. Okay, this person has the messaging we like. We're going to boost him.
Yeah.
She over there, we don't like what she's saying, so we're going to de-boost her. And now we've basically made everybody an agent of Operation Mockingbird simply through algorithmic manipulation. And yeah, maybe we'll pay some influencers to send out certain tweets and create certain messaging, you know. So maybe we'll still have some sort of, you know, quasi-Mockingbird agents, but really we can accomplish most of it now just through tweaking the algorithms with our AI systems.
It's unbelievable. I'm telling you, it's like five to 10 years away from, like, these machines starting to really ramp up in terms of taking over human jobs. Once that happened, this is why... That's why Sam Altman and who else is it that sat down and they're like, yeah, basically, Harari, right? The World Economic Forum guy,
right.
Jew, the gay Jew.
Gay Jew.
They're like, basically, we just need video games and drugs, he said. You know, that's what they're, what do we need human, what do we need all these humans for, right, essentially? Right. And if you don't have it, because think about it. A company won't think of the long term. Like, oh, well, you know, we replace humans, then who no salaries out. They just think, we can replace this guy, this menial task, with this job. And it's not the same as just like...
Zuckerberg's already talking about that. He got on Rogan a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago now.
Yeah.
And he talked about how they, in 2025, they're going to start replacing human coders and programmers with AI, because AI can do a lot of it now.
Yeah.
And it's something like, you know, one coder now can do the work of 1.5 coders or something, like using AI or something. And so, that you know, they're going to be able to start displacing coders now. Of course, you know, this is an argument against needing to bring in, you know, more Indians on H-1B.
That is true. Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't, you know.
They'll do that anyway.
They'll do it anyway, right? But, you know, so they're already moving that direction, right, replacing people. And, of course, if you can get a robot to do the, you know, 24/7, 365, doesn't take sick time, doesn't take vacation, doesn't need to sleep, doesn't talk back,
you know,
that's great.
It's a no-brainer, exactly. Yeah, you'll replace that real quick. I mean, we're talking about prices. If the production ramps up, you know, estimation on this. These units, kind of in the vein of what I showed here earlier, Tesla bots a little bit different, but it's, you know, mostly the same. $20,000 maybe. Some
right. Point. Like people, a car. Like a car.
People are going to have these things in their home, right?
Yeah. They'll probably rent them, though, because they don't want an owner.
Oh, at least. No, of course. Yeah. No, that's true. You'll own nothing.
You'll have a monthly subscription to your robot.
Lease,
you know?
Everything, exactly. Yeah, you won't own anything. You could be kicked out at any point. You don't submit. You don't obey. You don't, you know, you're out,
you're
essentially.
Out.
And there's no alternative society to go to. Not yet, anyway. So, but yeah, it's an interesting time. I'm seeing this.
But we know they're going to do it because they've already done it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
The same people.
Yeah.
So we know that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
We don't need to guess.
I wonder if the tech is different now in the sense of the level of control that you can have as opposed to what we've seen prior, right? I mean, it's different now. At least the dependency on these digital technologies and stuff, right? You can't live in society without them.
What can you do if you don't have a smartphone now? There's still holdouts with flip phones and analog landlines, but like, realistically, it's very difficult. It's very difficult anymore. How many websites and government agencies, you have to download the app. You have to get online to do this business. There's like literally no other way to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Oh, it's coming. So heads up, ladies and gentlemen. All right. I think that's let's end on the doom. that's a good idea. Sam, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's an interesting conversation.
Good time, yeah.
Very, very interesting conversation. So Sam Parker Senate, is that the best place?
I'm on two accounts now because this is the one that got demonetized and de-verified, and it's actually de-boosted. I get like 1% of the reach I used to on this account now since Elon nuked me. It's still alive. I still tweet on it, so you need to follow it. The other one is Based Sam Parker, also on Twitter. Based Sam Parker.
Gotcha. And then you have a flow page with all the
links?
It's
a flow page. It's got links to all the rest of my stuff, you know, Gab, Telegram, Instagram, Facebook, if you want to donate or support me. It's got crypto, Venmo, PayPal, Cash App, all that stuff too. buy me a coffee.
Fantastic. Yeah. Indeed, support Sam and his work. I want to add, there was a couple of super chats here. Let's end on this. Albert, thank you so much. Always good to see you. Hope you're doing well. Thank you so much for that generous donation. He says, hi, Henrik. Looking forward to the Sam Parker today. Always like his takes on X. I haven't had much time to look over the JFK files, but I saw that Israel intelligence was mentioned. I'm actually surprised the whole thing wasn't redacted. I am too, as we talked about. I also saw on Infowars this week that BlackRock is bankrupting Joanne Fabrics and taking over industries using some banking loan scheme. Oh, well, I'm not surprised by that.
Yeah, I saw about that. Joanne Fabrics going out of business.
Yep, and yep. Many of them are going out of business now, too. But it's also kind of this is the other thing that we didn't talk about, but that's the other part of it, right? Of basically, like, they're going to just three, like, products, the way we think of them, again, like, they'll be able to just, like, basically churn these out of, like, factories. They're like, right. Have you seen that now? They take solid components that were before, like, kind of like they're welded, or they had to, like a forgery, you mold them and you shape them, whatever. Yeah. They just print them now, essentially. Like
3D printing.
3D printing, essentially, yeah. Like metal pieces and everything. But production is going to change if this happens, of course. There's always a chance of, things, there's a spanner in the works somewhere. But production is going to change. Work is going to change if they get their way.
But Joanne Fabrics is profitable. From what I understand, it's a profitable company.
Yeah.
And it's getting nuked anyway.
But it was some loan scheme. Yeah, I got to look into that. Thank you for the update on that, Albert. Appreciate it. It says, great interview with Germar this week. Well, thank you. Take care. You as well. Thank you, Albert, so much. Always a pleasure seeing you. And thank you again for your generous support. Bill Biz, thank you as well for your super chat. It says, Henrik, great to see Sam Parker interview. Yes, indeed. We're glad to have him here in the studio. Odin says, sorry I'm late. Hope you both are doing well getting UAV'd like a motherfucker. He's in Kiev, this guy. Motherfucker out here in Kiev, take some shekels. Well, thank you. Yeah, stay safe over there, man, because I saw some, was this some nuclear facility that was bombed in Russia today? Whoa. Some drone or something?
Really?
I didn't follow up on it. I didn't have time before we came on here, but, the peace process here might come with some nasty strikes before it. We'll see what happens. Rebel Science says, love the show, great guest. AGI will be their downfall, will it? Could be the way to lock it in. Artificial generative intelligence, right? It's a difference there too. My point is, they'll sell this like an omnipotent god, essentially, right? They're going to say that it knows better than us, it knows better than you, and all of us collectively.
It's going to make your life better.
Make it much better, easier. Yeah. You know, save a lot of money on this. Excuse me, I'm so angry. I'm hitting the mic right now. All right, okay, that's a good time to wrap up. Anything else, Sam? Any closing thoughts?
No, I appreciate you having me on. It's good to be here. Good to meet you guys in person. You know, you had me on before, and it's always a good time. I always feel like I learn a lot from you and from just the interaction, and I hope that other people got something out of this. But, good to be here. I'm glad you had me on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate the time. Thank you for stopping by. Good having you here. All right, guys. We'll see you tomorrow then for Flashback Friday. We're going to actually have Greg Reese joining us in the second hour for that, too. He has some interesting updates. I think he jumped ship from Infowars. I think there's still a good term, but we'll ask him about them. We'll see what happens. But anyway, tune in tomorrow then for Flashback Friday. Usually at 5 p.m. Eastern we start. That's currently 10 p.m. Central European time because the clock issue there. So that's a little bit off. But anyway, we'll see you guys tomorrow. Thank you again. Book first. See you later.
New Red Ice merch available now. Oak First t-shirts for adults and for toddlers. Fatigues for men. Our favorite, the Red Ice Camper mug or ceramic with black print. High quality leather keychain with solar boat imprint. Our Red Ice hat, one of our best sellers. Pick one up today. Or why not? Gray Auslander Rouse t-shirts for both women and men. We also have Fridge Magnets, Folk, Burst, One Disease, and our black men's t-shirt with the classic red solar boat. Folk First. Get your Red Ice merch from LanasLlama.com. Get an item today. Lana's Llama, proud sponsor of Red Ice.
Thank you for watching. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up for exclusive members content. Don't miss our latest shows, interviews, and other videos only for subscribers. You can also become a member by signing up at subscribestar.com/redice. get full access, and help support our work. See you on the other side. Hello and welcome to the Stu Peters Show. I am Lana alongside Henrik of Red Ice, and we are guest hosting for Stu while he's away. The hot topic, of course, is JFK. Who killed him and why? This has been the subject of countless movies and books. Well, the JFK files were released. 64,000 pages, some unredacted, some that have already been out for decades, and other details that were known but not confirmed until now. And more will be coming out in the coming days. The notion of a mysterious curse on the Kennedy family is an obvious smokescreen. In the 70s, the mainstream establishment played a major role in steering conspiracy theorists toward the CIA while avoiding any hint of Israeli involvement. The unsolved murders of JFK and his two legitimate heirs, his younger brother Robert and his only son John, require a more rational explanation. And that explanation is clearly the deep state of Israel. Now, Henrik, it wasn't just the CIA, but let's begin talking about the CIA and then get into the Israel connections.
Well, when you talk about the CIA, you really talk about the Mossad, and that's partially what I think some of these documents have revealed over the last couple of days here. Essentially, there's no distinction between the two, and it looks like actually CIA is doing the bidding of the Mossad. And in fact, kind of the CIA chief counterintelligence officer, James Jesus Angleton, who, of course, was there at the time when JFK was assassinated, seemed to cover a tremendous amount for Israel and for Jewish interest, essentially, right? I mean, Stu Peters linked up a couple of examples here in the documents that have been coming out, and there's so many of them. We should mention that real quick, too. There's almost 2,000 PDFs. So this will take a little bit of time to kind of weed through what's new, what's old, but I've seen some things resurfacing again and kind of gaining traction and popularity because, of course, now there's buzz around this issue again. So this is a net positive, I think, right? But simple matters such as this, where basically, the Israeli intelligence services mentions of Israel in these documents have been redacted. Now, these are unredacted, obviously, which is good. But previously, these things have been redacted. Why? Why are they trying to cover this up? Why is this so important? You know,
it's
there's
like they're
many
covering
things.
Up their Israel first agenda within U.S. politics and agencies. That's what it looks like to me.
So most of these have this. There's no objection to these being released, only these needs to be redacted, and of course those are circled in red, different mentions of Mossad, Israel, and so forth, right? But it's very interesting with the James Jesus Angleton, right? And here he actually is with the head of the global operations of the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service.
Looks like one of us, and of course, yes. Angleton has a Mexican mother.
Yes, and we'll talk more about that later. What his interest in this is really, it's curious, but there might be some explanations, right? But Meir Amit, they're photographed here in 1966, so this is a few years after the JFK assassination, but their relationship continued, and they were on very good terms. If you read some kind of official accounts, they're like, well, it was kind of strained at times and difficult and whatnot, but most of these things have played out in any type of disagreement between the CIA and Israel have, as far as I can tell, for the most part, benefited Israel and their objectives.
Yes.
And that's because the people inside of the CIA and other agencies in the
they're
U.S.,
convicted.
As we know, they're aboard. Some people call them moles or whatnot. Here's a very interesting case, right, of the Israeli account, because James Jesus Angleton became head of the Israeli, they call it office, or the Israeli account is one reference they use for it as well. And when he did that, of course, then he did completely everything they wanted. It's very interesting. They mentioned Pollard here in the beginning. And, of course, he wasn't pardoned by Trump. Some people have said that. But it's actually Jonathan Pollard's handler that was pardoned at the time. But Pollard's his parole was up, essentially. He came to Israel. He was welcomed by Netanyahu. He, of course, famously gave away a lot of these U.S. intelligence secrets. He was working in the Navy to not only Israel, but also many of them ended up in the hands of the Soviet Union. And he claimed that he did this because, well, American intelligence inside of there, their anti-Semitism is rampant and they're not doing what's best for Israel. Mm-hmm. So he decided to, you know, give them all this information. And then he gave some of it to the Soviet Union in exchange for Soviet Jews so they could emigrate to Israel. So this is like an ethnic interests issue all along the way.
Yeah. And of course, Kennedy was in conflict with the state of Israel. He didn't support them developing nuclear weapons. Right. So there's reasons for them to not like JFK. He stood in the way of their Israel agenda.
Absolutely. Pollard said, all of us Jews have dual loyalty, whether they know it or not. And that's, I think that's true. Many of them, they claim they're not pro-Zionist or pro-Israel. They absolutely are.
You don't have to be in the Mossad to do work for the Mossad. You know what I mean?
Well, that's just it, that they have handlers. And of course, if they don't have the blackmailing thing, which is a completely different ballgame altogether, they play dirty. No doubt about it. It says here, after they go into Pollard a little bit, they talk about the strenuous relationships, right? For 35 years, the Israeli accounts have been the main channel through which the CIA and the Israeli intelligence services, Mossad, have exchanged classified data on Soviet espionage activities because the Soviet Union was the big boogeyman, apparently, right? They kind of united around that. But then it turns out, oh, no, actually, we're giving the Soviet Union information as well. So we're fooling you while we claim that we're your ally, essentially. One account from many that they interviewed that were part of creating this document, the Israeli account, said everything in the relationship between intelligence services is like a double-edged sword. On one hand, there's the friendly aspect, but on the other, there's the counterintelligence aspect in which you try to get as much as you can and keep others from getting things from you. So despite the fact that it was this, you know, Soviet Union issue, you, of course, have famous cases where, like the Rosenbergs, for example, also gave information to the Soviet Union. Now, they were executed eventually. They were like, you know, communist spies or whatever. But I think they were Jewish first. They weren't communist first. They were Jewish first and whatever, you know, benefited Israel, essentially. Here's another very interesting quote as well regarding who has provided potential money for all of this as well. The different groups that were involved at the time, there seems to be some particular activity in Chicago at the time. Even though some of the early predecessors to the to AIPAC had a presence in Chicago. But check out this quote here. This is from Homer S. Ekvaria, I think you pronounce that, a Cuban anti-Castro activist with ties to militant revolutionary groups. He told an ATF informant on November 21st, 1963 in Chicago, quote, "We now have plenty of money. Our new backers are Jews. As soon as we, or they, take care of Kennedy." Mm-hmm. And of course, he was assassinated literally the day after that, right? So here's a close-up of the document there highlighted.
And there are some people saying, oh, this is fake, it's fraudulent. No, there's an archived version that's been out of this, that's been out for a while.
For a long time, yes.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. It's just a quote from somebody. It bears no no weight, essentially. But this is not true either, obviously. This was, at the time, taken seriously, and they knew about the person. Article talks about this, so basically, you know, taking care of Canada, whatever. And eventually, this piece of information, which they had on IRVAC, and, you know, Mosley as well is one of them, an ATF informant who reported this conversation to the Secret Service. And eventually, the Secret Service, that investigation was taken over by the FBI, and once it ends up in their hands, as it says here, they quickly dropped this case and just left it and said, let's not pretend about anything, and just walk away, like they have done so many times, right? So this is the same old story, essentially. Now, there's the question of James, I think it's Jesus, because of his Mexican mom, right?
Yeah, who is this guy?
Jesus Angleton. It's very interesting. There are actually memorials to Angleton in Israel. That were dedicated at the time by high officials in Israel. Hmm. One stone outside of Angleton's beloved oasis, the King David Hotel, actually has an inscription on it that says, "In memory of a dear friend." It's an interesting piece here. "The Goy and the Golem, James Angleton and the Rise of Israel." And he talks a lot about this. It's from a book called The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. It says that Angleton was the leading architect of America's strategic relationship with Israel that endures and dominates the region to this day. More than any other man, the longtime chief of the U.S. counterintelligence made possible Israel's shift from, quote, an embattled settler state into a strategic ally of the world's great superpower. Of course, we know that they're not a very good ally, as we've talked about so many times. But Angleton, it says here, did so chiefly by burying an effort in the U.S. intelligence establishment to question Israel's acquisition of nuclear weapons in the 1960s. Angleton's loyalty to Israel betrayed U.S. policy on an epic scale, Morley writes. Instead of supporting U.S. nuclear security policy, he ignored it. Right? And there's so much in this book that we could pull out. But there is the question of his mother, which I think is a valid question to ask, right? He was actually born in Boise, Idaho, but his mom was Mexican. His dad, I think, was kind of Anglo. But Moreno is her last name. Her name is, the full name is Carmen Mercedes Moreno. And of course, as we know, Moreno can be a Sephardic Jewish surname. And we're raising this because we're wondering, what did he get out
What's
of this?
What's his drive?
What is the
obsession
drive
with Israel? Exactly.
Right. And so the question is, well, maybe they had something on him. Maybe he was Epstein. Maybe there's a blackmailing type of scheme going on way back in the day. We don't know. Maybe there's another reason. Maybe this was religious to him.
Yeah, it's very religious. He could be convicted.
It could be.
Like, he believes in it.
So, you know, Morano is another name that was used as well, and that was a Christianized Jew or a Moor as well. These were common names for so-called cryptos or they converted or whatnot. So it's possible that his mother was this and that he was aware of this. And to, so on some level, he did have or agreed with those type of ethnic interests that he encountered when he worked together or for, I should say, behalf of Israel and Mossad, essentially. So basically, when you implicate the CIA, you also implicate the Mossad. There's no distinction between the two, and they seem to have gotten their claws into the right people at the right time in order to get us to this position where we are now. Yeah. JFK is a linchpin in that,
too,
by
the way. So let's talk about what he was doing at that time.
Yeah, so JFK was basically pushing for an inspection of the Dimona nuclear facility in Israel at the time, right? Israel is famously not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, right, the NPT, and has not actually accepted the IAEA's, the International Atomic Energy Agency's, safeguards on some of its principal nuclear activities. And so we can play a clip here, which is very interesting, where they talk about Ben-Gurion, how he was pressured by JFK. And
Ben, of course, he was the national founder and first prime minister of the state of Israel.
That's right. Exactly. And so Martin Sandler, another Jewish guy who was the editor of the letters of John F. Kennedy, talked about this and the fact that this, he claims, that this led to the resignation of Ben-Gurion. But it was almost like a vengeance tactics over this whole thing of the Dimona nuclear reactor. He was very skeptical about this. And this is just one thing, by the way. There's many things that JFK did. But this seems to be a big one. In fact, there was inspections that the U.S. did at the time at Dimona where the Israelis there had set up like a fake control room and things like this as a theater, as a stage in order to divert anybody from understanding what actually was going on at that place. But here's Martin Sandler. Listen to this.
There's a very surprising series of letters between Kennedy and David Ben-Gurion, not only the prime minister, premier of Israel, but the founder of Israel, in which they're very angry letters, in which Kennedy is saying to Ben-Gurion, I'm killing myself trying to get a nuclear test ban treaty. I've even got de Gaulle on board, and that's impossible. And you keep testing in Dimona. You've got to stop. And Ben-Gurion, thank you, in so many words says, it's easy for you to say sitting in Hyannisport. I'm sitting with the Arabs all around me, and you want me to give up nuclear testing. And Kennedy threatens him, and he threatens him in such a way that Ben-Gurion resigns. And I will tell you that I found articles, not in any crackpot publications, but in very sophisticated publications saying Forget Lyndon Johnson. Forget the CIA. Forget Fidel Castro. The Mossad killed Kennedy because they were so upset over what he did to Ben-Gurion. So, you know, we got a few little bombshells we throw in there, not proven.
Yes, I hear you.
Yeah, how about that, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting. A little bit of a revelation. These things come from many different directions, and there's enough clues and whispers about this and that. But, of course, it hasn't helped that they've covered this up so much along the way. And when you start redacting Israel or Mossad or Israeli intelligence services from these documents, people are left wondering, like, who are we talking about here? Like, who are behind some of these things?
That's right. But hold that thought. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back. I'm Lana, along with Henrik, and we're filling in for Stu Peters, who is away. You can find us at redice.tv, redicemembers.com, on X, Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey, and more. We produce live streams, unique videos, and interviews. All right, where were we?
Yes, we're talking about the Dimona nuclear reactor, the inspections there, JFK's pushback against us. He didn't want Israel to have nuclear weapons. That was just one of the things that he did in order to arouse the anger of the Zionists in Israel at the time.
And, of course, the Federal Reserve, that has to be said. I mean,
yeah, there's things there in terms of him taking away the silverbacks, I believe it was, mm-hmm. and then going to greenbacks, and he wanted a gold-backed $2 bill. So that what it was. I'm a little fuzzy on the exact history of that. But, yes, it was monetary reasons. There were nuclear activity when it comes to Israel. He wanted to lessen the impact, of course, of the Federal Reserve and things like this, right? And then, of course, you had the other issue, which I thought we'd look at next, which has to do with his brother, Robert F. Kennedy, who, of course, also was assassinated later by the usual suspect. Now, this
and
is
he was when, also not a supporter of Israel. And
not.
One of the reasons people think that it makes sense that he was assassinated is because he was winning the primaries. So he would most likely be the next Democratic nominee at that time. And then he would become president. And so, again, he would be blocking, you know, these Israeli interests. And he can open up an investigation into his brother's death once he became president, where he would find out about the Israeli deep state within America.
Yeah, because back in 1962, about a year or so before JFK was assassinated, Robert F. Kennedy was working as the attorney general under his brother, the president JFK at the time. And he actually was one who pushed to get the American Zionist Council to register under the FARA Act, right, the Foreign Agents Registrations Act, essentially. The Israeli Lobby Archive has a detailed kind of timeline on this, and they talked about how many millions that they were pouring in at the time in lobbying activity, which is one of the reasons why RFK was concerned about this, essentially. And by the way, the American Zionist Council, they did eventually change name. I think they became the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America. But, of course, it's kind of an umbrella group, and AIPAC was under that. That was a parent organization. And so AIPAC is kind of involved in this at the same time. And if they've gone through with this, there would have been questions about other type of lobbying groups as well,
That's right, by the way.
And, you know, be they Israeli or Jewish or whatnot. But this was something that was like a step too far for them. So, granted, it was Robert F. Kennedy that pushed this. But this, you know, regardless, it was under the auspices of, JFK. And I think they saw them eventually probably just as they see an ethnic threat. This was a family. They saw them as together. They are not good for us. They're not good for Israel. They're not good for the Jews. And so the Kennedy clan is a threat.
Yeah, it's
to
true.
Us.
I mean, because even JFK Jr., in the 90s, he started talking about, you know, Zionist Jewish conspiracies. And so, like, uh-oh, well, that guy's got to go. And then there was this mysterious plane crash, right, in Martha's Vineyard, where his pregnant wife and his sister-in-law also died. It's like they couldn't have that line existing at all. RFK Jr. today, I mean, he is just not in line with the Kennedys on this Israel thing, unfortunately.
He's not the same guy.
Well, he's not the same.
Rabbi Shmuley is following him along, and he's making sure that they have him on a leash, I think, right? That's why the HHS immediately did that, like, anti-Semitism statement, how that's a health threat, essentially. It was like, what does this got to do with the Human and Health Services Department? But anyway, there we go, something with Zionism and anti-Semitism. But back to this issue here. Even Donald Rumsfeld actually sent a letter at the time to Robert F. Kennedy to kind of casually warn him that this is concerning, right? This is July 15th, 1963, addressed to Robert F. Kennedy, as we said, and Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld here, one of the, you know, neocons. He was part of the, you know, Iraq invasion under George Bush and all that stuff. We know who he is, right? Several thoughtful and valued constituents have expressed their concern to me over a report in the June 28th issue of the Chicago, here we go with the Chicago, right, edition of the Wall Street Journal, which indicated that the determination by the Justice Department of the question of the registration of the American Zionist Council as an agent of the Israeli government will depend upon, quote, risk of offending Jewish opinion in the United States.
And look at us now. look at what our greatest ally has given us today.
Yes, I would greatly appreciate your comments on this statement and also a report as to the policy the Department of Justice will follow in determining this question. This is the prime issue of many of these American politicians for some interesting reason.
Numerous Jewish journalists have detailed Lyndon B. Johnson's personal and emotional connection to Israel, confirmed by historians and interviews with his wife, family members, and political associates. In 2013, Associated Press reported about newly released tapes from Johnson's White House office that pointed out that under Johnson, the United States became Israel's chief diplomatic ally and primary arms supplier. An article from the Five Towns Jewish Times says our first Jewish president, Lyndon Johnson, and concludes that President Johnson firmly pointed American policy in a pro-Israel direction. The article also mentions that research into Johnson's personal history indicates that he inherited his concern for the Jewish people from his family. His aunt, Jessie Johnson Hatcher, was a major influence on him, and she was a member of the Zionist Organization of America. And in an additional note, the line of Jewish mothers, they say, can be traced back three generations in Lyndon Johnson's family tree. There is no doubt that he was Jewish. Now, this was in a Jewish publication. Also, as a young boy, Lyndon watched his politically active grandfather seek clemency for the Jewish pedophile murderer, Leo Frank. Yuck. And soon after taking office in the aftermath of JFK's assassination in 1963, Johnson told an Israeli diplomat, "You have lost a very great friend, but you have found a better one." Now, whatever was the reason of his loyalty to Israel, it's because of him that Israel could continue its military nuke program and acquire its first atomic bomb around 1965. And thanks to JFK's death, Israel was also able to carry out its plan to annex Palestinian territories beyond the boundaries imposed by the UN partition plan. By leaning on the Pentagon and the CIA, Johnson intensified the Cold War and created the climate of tension which Israel needed in order to demonize Egyptian President Nasser and project the false idea that they are our greatest ally in the Middle East. Yeah, Lyndon Johnson, he was a pervert and he was a crook in many ways. He was a turncoat. He took over the White House in 1963 and he became so unpopular that he retired in 1968. So I think it's safe to say that JFK was assassinated for Israel. So prior to Lyndon Johnson, there wasn't this crazy obsession with Israel all the time in American politics. But following JFK's assassination and when Lyndon took over, there was this obsession with Israel. And of course, you know, the civil rights movement and all that kicked off.
Yeah, I mean, religiously, they had planted the Scofield Bible before that. These were in political evangelical circles, obviously, but this is beginning to kind of take a front facing, you know, direction
in politics
at that time, essentially. I mean, it was always, not always there, but it's been there for a long time. But now it's beginning to rear its ugly head. And now they're forced to do showing kind of their dirty tricks openly. And of course, they're so good in the sense of what they do that they have control of some of these individuals that keep covering for them. But it's very interesting you brought this up here, right? Lyndon Johnson, his potential connections through his mom's line then?
Yes.
You know, to Jews.
And these are Jewish historians, and you know that they really check this stuff out.
Like, well, they do. Know. They study all of these things. They have a very astute historical understanding.
That would explain more of his obsession and why his aunt was in the Zionist org of America and his grandfather trying to bail out Leo Frank, like all these things. Otherwise, why the obsession? I don't understand.
Even if it was not, I think what that points to is early blackmail operations. You basically have to think Epstein. They Epstein people, and the question is that we don't have any answers to right now is how far back does that go? Who did that originally? Was it that they filmed someone in some hotel room here or there? Like, they managed to get their claws in these people. They have their vices, these dirty politicians. They think of themselves, not the country or the agenda of their people, obviously, right? Unlike these guys seem to do. But yeah, Lyndon Johnson, Israel has no better friend. Historians generally regard Johnson as the president's most uniformly friendly to Israel, which is very, very interesting. There's a couple of things here we can pull out as well. Do you remember this? When shortly after the assassination, I mean, literally within what, an hour? I forget how quickly this happened. But when LBJ is sworn in on Air Force One, he turns towards Congressman Albert Thomas and make this interesting wink, basically like, we got him kind of thing. It's very interesting. Now, he had a connection to the Nuclear Atomic Commission, I think it was. He was on the board of that. Again, I'm not sure. Is that a Dimona connection? Nuclear? I don't know. But regardless, there are some people that knew. And, of course, here's in front of the distraught wife here, right, Jackie Kennedy. You can see the anguish on her face. And he's very happy that he's being sworn in. And so they took him out, and they got LBJ in place. And, of course, the rest is history. It's not that things weren't bad before that, but it really starts collapsing at that point. I know that JFK introduced, the Civil Rights Act or whatnot, but LBJ, he's really the one who kind of took credit for that, right?
Yeah, he signed it. He took credit for it. So, JFK wasn't perfect. Obviously, there's things that we can criticize about his politics, right? But on why was he assassinated? Clearly, it's the issue of Israel.
Yeah. And as I said, think of Epstein, right? This is what we have to keep in mind, that we are dealing with a group that necessarily don't have the morals that we do. They don't think like we do. They act very, very differently. It's a ruthless ethnic interest and struggle for them, and they're historically very astute of this, as I said. I mean, this goes back to, like, they have a grief against Romans still to this day. They have a grief against anybody who they happen to dislike or stands in their way, essentially. America was a problem for a while because they didn't let them in, and then after that, Germany, obviously, that's a big problem. So they lie, they steal, they cheat, they blackmail, and yes, they kill, they assassinate in order to get achieved what they want to achieve. This is part of the repertoire. And if they can't do that, I think they resort to blackmailing, like they did with Epstein, essentially.
Yeah.
In fact, we could play another clip here. This is Truman. And of course, he had a lot of problems too. But even him showing what a dilemma this was at the time Palestine.
The American population, they didn't want to get involved. They didn't care. Now here we are, fast forward, it's just that's the obsession on the left and the right? Israel. Yeah, let's play the clip.
We had several other people in the country, even among the Jews, the Zionists particularly, who were against anything that was to be done if they couldn't have the whole of Palestine and everything handed to them on a silver plate so they wouldn't have to do anything. It couldn't be done. We had to take it in small doses. You can't move 5 or 6 million people out of a country and fill it up with 5 or 6 million more and expect both sets of them to be pleased.
49.
But don't think that decision to recognize Israel is an easy one. I had to make a compromise with the Arabs and divide Palestine. The Jews wanted to chase all the Arabs into the Tigris and Euphrates River, and the Arabs wanted to chase all the Jews into the Red Sea, and what I was trying to do was to find a homeland for the Jews and still be just with the Arabs.
Do you know what he said there about they want to push them into the Euphrates and Tigris? That's where the Likud party's original slogan was actually from the river to the sea, remember?
Yes.
And the response to that was what, you know, pro-Palestinians picked up of like, from the river to the sea, we will be free.
Yeah.
So that whole thing was actually initiated. That whole slogan was initiated by these, you know, crazy Zionists, essentially.
Yeah.
But there's some people that claim to Truman, too. Same thing there, right? That they were
there was a
black
switch.
Man techniques, and they were going after him. And many of these people didn't want to do their bidding, but they were forced to because now they were, you know, personally compromised. They would have risked their family
That's
lives,
how they
their
do
reputation.
It in politics. Yeah.
Exactly. Right? So, this is essentially the control that they have, right? Now, I want to mention, again, the context here a little bit, too, of some other things around the JFK assassination, one of which, of course, is how this kind of comes together, right? Abraham Zapruder, Jewish immigrant from Ukraine at the time, unexpectedly just happened to capture the shooting, right, of JFK. And, of course, this was the redacted version of this was out for a long time, and I forget how many years later the actual, you know, the gruesome footage was released where you actually see his brains are blown out. And I don't even think we have to get into like, well, the grassy knoll, was it the driver who shot? Who was? I mean, that's interesting. And obviously that should be discussed. But all these moving parts around is what lays the puzzle and solves the riddle of sorts to me in a way, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And there's so many of these people's involvements along the way. Let's take one more here. Which of course,
because obviously the guy who shot him wasn't the mastermind. It's all the people behind the telling the guy to go do it. So we can, you know, get in the weeds of how that shooting happened and who was it and who put him. But it's more interesting of who put him in place. Why?
Yes.
It's the more interesting part.
The other one, of course, is Jack Ruby, real name Jacob Leon Rubenstein, who, of course, famously shot the patsy Lee Harvey Oswald before he could talk, right?
If we can testify and spill the beans about everything and show the truth, yeah.
Rubenstein was Jewish, after all. So there's these right people at the right place at the right time. I don't buy the book depository, all this stuff, right? The JFK film, even, quick mention of that. Oliver Stone directed it. Who funded it? Arnon Milshan, who is literally an Israeli spy. He's very active in Hollywood. Stone wanted a 4.5-hour film with a potential budget of $40 million, double what Stone had agreed to with Warner Brothers. And by the way, the other guy in Warner Brothers said, this is a great idea. It was Terry Semel, another Jewish guy, but Arnon
Milshan. So this is why we don't hear about the Israeli connection, all these countless JFK movies and books and all these, you know, Jewish-owned publications.
Like, that's right.
We never hear that, right?
So Arnon Milshan, the Israeli spy, eventually footed the bill, essentially, for this. Milshan was eager to work on the project and launch his new company, Regency Enterprises, with a high-profile film like JFK. So Milshan made a deal with Warner Bros. To put up the money for the film. Stone managed to pare down his initial revision, a 190-page draft, down to a 156-page shooting script. So what disappeared? What was there? And these guys come in and whoops, there you go.
They edit. It's that time again. We'll be right back after this break. And we're back. I'm Lana. Joining me is Henrik. We're filling in for Stu Peters, who is away. Now let's get back to our conversation on Israel.
Well, I want to mention that real quick, too, that you got to put Israel at that time in historical context. You have to understand that this is a nation, when JFK gets assassinated, that is, what, not even 2 decades, right, old? They were steeped in these types of tactics. I mean, people have made the argument, and I would agree, Israel is a terrorist nation. They were founded on terrorism. There's a couple of examples we can do. We can talk about some of the different groups at the time, what they did. As we said, they had grievances with every group in that area and in that region at the time. But we can begin with the bombing of the King David Hotel, for example. Mm-hmm. What about that? On July 22nd, 1946, the Irgun, a Jewish underground organization, and they always call it that. It's like, oh, no, it's totally nothing to do with us, guys. It's like, well, they did your bidding, and now you got what you wanted because of, you know, bombs going off. They bombed the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, as we said, the British administrative headquarters for Mandatory Palestine, killing 91 people and injuring 45. That's terrorism. And these are... Was it the British mandate, right, as we said, at the time. King David Hotel, this is where Our friend there, James Jesus Angleton, had his little stone inscribed eventually and things like that too. They've received a lot of people that have they've made dedications to and things like this. And they haven't kind of, officially Israel has been like, oh, Canada, that was no good. You know, what, be it the Lehi is another terrorist group, or the Irgun, what they're involved in and what they did or whatnot. But this was sanctioned by them for sure. So in Israel, it was a problem with the Romans. You know, eventually there's a problem with the Britons. Then it was a problem with the Americans. And now it's, you know, whoever sets their foot there and don't do their bidding, that's a problem. And they go after them and they terrorize them.
Yes.
They assassinate people. They kill them. You know what I mean? This should be bigger, just outrage around this. But because it was like, it's back in 1946. It's fine. They've just gone through the Holocaust, you see. So, and you know, but you have to put that in context too, right? That even the outrage exaggerations kind of around, you know, the purported Holocaust, and we don't have to get into whether, you know, try to break down official narratives and things like this. But I'm saying, regardless, that mentality then was basically like, you need to do anything to survive. We must have a Jewish. This actually served the Zionist very well as an incentive, right, at the time. And of course, even Hitler famously did cooperate and work with the Zionists at the time. There's commemorative coins that have the swastika on one side and the Star of David on the other. He actually wanted to get them out of Europe. You know what I mean? And Israel might not have been an ideal place. I'm not sure how much, you know, the Germans at that time thought about that. But it was like, okay, at least we'll get them out of Europe, right?
Yeah, I mean, where do you take them? Yeah, I mean, that's proof they didn't want to exterminate them all. You just wanted them to live somewhere else.
Well, there was a deal. In fact, it was the...
Yeah, go over there.
This is the thing. It was actually many of the top Jews at the time that betrayed their own. And this is my point that I made before, that they're willing to sacrifice even their own. Yes, they're willing to kill others for their cause.
Well, it's all in their religious texts. Yeah. So why not?
The transfer agreement, right? That was, forget his first name, Black, the Jewish author, the transfer agreement. And it was, you know, famous of how they betrayed a lot of them. They did not want to take them out of the concentration camps. There's a statement by another rabbi, I forget his name now, but he did famously say that when this is done, when this is settled, when the dust settles after the war is over, we as Jews, we need to show that, like, we have bled too. I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something to that effect, that we have sacrificed something. When we come to the table, we must show that we also have, like, bled in order to, like, get what we want out of the situation, right? So anyway, so that's the bombing of the King David Hotel. That's just one example, right? What about the assassination of the Swedish diplomat, Folke Bernadotte? He was part of the Swedish royal family. And after the initial war that they had, right, prior to this, Bernadotte was actually chosen by the United Nations Security Council to be a mediator in the Israeli-Arab conflict of 1947 to 1948. And he was assassinated in Jerusalem in 1948 by the paramilitary Zionist group Lehi that we mentioned before. And this is basically their way of saying thank you for him saving, allegedly, you know, he got out, what was it, 400 Jews, Danish Jews or something like that. Like, he actually helped and he aided them. And then he went there and basically like, hey, we should try to have peace. We should try to get along. We want to help you out here. Boom, they shot him, right? They did not like this. So this is one of the reasons, actually, why Sweden and many other European countries have been very, at least on paper, kind of anti-Israel. And it's now when European, you know, right-wing nationalist parties supposedly are gaining more traction and getting more votes, that they're more leaning towards Israel. It's this weird thing with Sweden, where the Sweden Democrats are finally, like, absolved officially the, like, Israeli policy towards them because they say they have a Nazi past, where they're like, oh, we're fine, we're bros, everything is good, you know, kind of thing. And so you see those developments, obviously, in Holland with Geert Wilders. You're seeing it in Italy with Meloni. You're seeing it in many.
It's every right-wing party, of
everywhere.
Course.
It's crazy, yeah. Right? Another one showing you also that they go after their own, right? Remember the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin? Classic case. The assailant, the assassinator there, his name was Yagal, if I pronounce that correctly, Amir, an Israeli law student and ultra-nationalist Zionist who radically opposed Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's peace initiative, particularly signing the Oslo Accord. See, a lot of the Nordic nations have been involved in trying to solve this, trying to make peace, trying to be nice to these people, help them out. And what happens? Nah, we're not doing any of that, right? Remember, you can actually go back to looking at some of the evidence that suggests that Netanyahu's regime and a lot of the upper, you know, Zionists at the Knesset in Israel have helped to fund and support Hamas, because this actually drove a wedge between the more kind of, you know, nationalistic but not as religiously fervent PLO, which was headed up by Yasser Arafat at the time. Mm. He's very popular in Palestine, actually. And then what they wanted, what the Israeli realized would be beneficial, is to create a more extreme religious group and actually fund them and help to support them in order to drive that wedge. And so instead of saying, look, they're obviously very, they're peaceful, they are ready to negotiate, what are you waiting for? The ball is in Israel's court. They don't want a two-state solution. Mm-hmm. They want a one-state solution.
That's right.
According to their God, this is their land. They've been given this land.
That's right.
And it's theirs. And they're going to get it at any... I mean, their Messiah won't come until this happens. They have to have the land. These are commandments, right?
And, of course, you're mentioning terrorism. We have to talk about 1967 and the attack against the USS Liberty, which... found out, okay, it was Israel, and what did they say? Oh, this was a targeting error. But, of course, they wanted to blame Egypt. I think this was a pretext for going to war, to getting into the Middle East. And now we're in the Middle East, and we can't seem to get out of the Middle East. And Israel is bombing Gaza again. It's resumed. So the terrorism just keeps on coming now.
And now
never
Trump,
ends. When does it end?
It doesn't. Now Trump is bombing Yemen as well, more civilians and mothers, daughters, sons and fathers, everyone is dying over there. Look, this goes back to the original kind of neoconservative, neocon plan that they talk about, 7 countries in 5 years. You know, famously Wesley Clark dropped this way back when. Granted, they're not quite on the timetable. They have been set back a few years or whatnot. But those overall kind of neoconservative Zionist aspirations have basically panned out.
Yes.
And essentially, the only thing that's left for them is Iran. And that's what they're talking about now. That's what's ramping up. Latest comments by Trump. And I think on the other side, I think Netanyahu has said something about this as well, that basically, you know, Iran is supporting Hamas. And so we have to go after Iran. So this is what we might be looking at. You got to remember, at the end of the day, the aspiration there, and it's more religious than just like ethnic, is world domination. They're the rightful heirs to, you know, to rule globally.
That's what they think.
They are the chosen people. And so this is what they're going to do. And so, they will try to aspire to that, no questions asked, right?
With all this talk of Israel now and the JFK files coming out, how do you think Zionists are going to spin this? I already see some people on the right are like, no, this is all part of the conspiracy because they want to keep the JQ going and they want to blame Israel. I don't know. I just find it interesting. This is I don't agree with that, but I find that this is interesting that these topics are coming out in a mainstream way and under Trump, which is a very Zionist government. Like, how are they going to spin this? What do you predict here?
I don't know. Maybe they'll have a guy show up at the CIA Langley offices and threaten them by, you know,
anti-Semitism.
I'm not sure, but apparently there was some shooter there, right? But plenty of distractions. Again, there's still the question of why Trump did this, or did they know? Unlike the Epstein files that we're still waiting for. Well, it's not even correct term. It's just we want the list of his clients, right? That's what we want. But even that was like, well, what is this? This doesn't make sense. So maybe they had to offer us something. It's like, all right, fine, give them the JFK files or something. But yes, they will spin it, try to cover it up, and basically try to ignore it and pretend.
Will RFK Jr. stop shilling for Israel now? Probably not.
No, definitely not.
Yeah,
no.
They'll just kind of look the other way. Well, that was then. This is now. No, it's still then. It's continuing. It's the same people. It's the same agenda. Just a different year.
Yeah, I mean, this is far from over. I think in their book, this is actually just beginning, to be honest. They're finally now, all those pieces that they've been
trying to lay
in place for such a long time is now finally kind of coming back in. And in fact, Netanyahu's latest statement there on Hamas is they're initiating a ground invasion now, I think. And again, and they're basically seeking to clean this out. Even Pollard that we talked about before, right, who came to Israel, kisses the ground, get a royal welcome by Netanyahu and things like that. For like, thank you for spying for us. You're a great service to our country and to our cause and whatnot like that. Even Pollard was supportive of basically taking every single Arab out of the Gaza Strip and sending them to Ireland, right? Isn't that what they had in mind? Send them to Ireland, send them to Sweden, France, Germany. I'm sure they want to ship some of them off to America.
Multiculturalism,
as well.
Multiracialism for Europe, but, you know, ethno-nationalism for Israel, right? Classic double standard. And by the way, if you point that out, you are an anti-Semite. This is in the working definition of anti-Semitism. It never ends. It's a list where they just keep adding. I'm sure they'll say saying that the JFK assassination had anything to do with Jews or Israel is also going to go in the working list of anti-Semitism.
I mean, it feels hopeless to talk about politicians that are good or decent or moral or upstanding, or they don't have, you know, they don't let themselves be blackmailed like this, like so many others have in the past. And it seems at this point it's so under control that you won't even have anybody who's independent outside of that system that will rise to the ranks of power and actually be able to do it in order to avoid being ensnared. Look at Thomas Massie, right? He's one of the few guys that they supposedly don't
and
have that control.
They did not let
of.
That guy in.
And,
nope.
I mean, yeah. I think it's AIPAC that said that they're going to raise more money than ever. Like, we'll raise 10 times as much as he does in order to just get his opponent in to get him out. He's apparently the one guy who hasn't taken any AIPAC money, and he seems to be genuine.
He called out dual citizens, yeah. Yeah.
See how rare that is, right? He talked about the AIPAC guy that everyone has in Congress and things like that. I mean, you do have the question, like, how do you get these people out? How do you stop this? And it seems at this point that they just have full lockdown on this. I think the light at the end of the tunnel is their hubris. They're always constantly overplaying their hand, right? It's too obvious. It's too much. Now they're like, we're going to deport people that are not sufficiently pro-Israel.
Like, they never know when to stop.
They
right?
don't know when
That's
to stop.
That's why they've been thrown out of so many countries in the past.
And this is, in a way, I hate that it resorts to that, that somehow, like, we're not getting the win. It's just them overplaying their hand. But we have to take that as an advantage, right, of exposing this, of showing this corruption, the blackmailing schemes, the assassinations, the backhanded tactics, and continue to tell people like that this is this is your greatest ally, spying on
presidents.
We
get anything from this. We get nothing from this relationship.
No.
They're a massive parasite that suck up billions of taxpayer money.
Yep, they're a parasite, and they're draining the U.S., and they're doing everything on the behalf of Israeli security and things like this.
And
right?
Now if you try and criticize it or say something about it, they want to pass laws to put you in jail like they already do in some European countries. Right? Well, that's anti-Semitic. You can't criticize a country. Even in a time of war, you can't criticize someone who happens to be Jewish when they're, you know, dropping bombs and genociding people. I mean, this is evil. This is an evil, rotten system to the core, and it needs to be exposed, and people need to organize and start thinking of ways, how are we going to fight back against this system and restore some kind of justice, some kind of order?
Well, I'll
some kind of American first policies here.
Indeed. I mean, I'll say this. It's easier than ever to expose this because it's all coming out now, essentially. Not all of it, maybe, but so much of it is coming out. And it's easier now than it has been in a very long time. So I'm actually encouraged, and we got to get these rotten politicians out of there.
Well, that was a quick hour. Thank you all for joining us. And thank you, Stu, for letting us fill in for you. And if you want to find us, if you want to watch all our content, our unique videos, our live streams, see our interviews, head over to redice.tv or redicemembers.com. Thank you all.
Thank you for watching, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you to Stu Peters as well.